have the rest of the day dedicated to a review of the last Groundfish Committee's work on Amendment 16. There are a series of motions which will come forward. The ultimate goal today is to go through that document with the assistance of the committee chair and staff to make sure that we've dotted our I's and crossed our T's in the hopes that we can send the document out to the public for comment, important comment. It's my belief that as we go through this process, that we seek to identify preferred alternatives such that we end up with a package that's a straw man management plan so that the public can focus its comments, tell us what's wrong with certain components of our plan, what they like, what they don't like. When they come across something they don't like, we have other alternatives or options in the document. They can suggest that we replace what we've suggested in our preferred, and they like option two better than option three. But I think that's an important part of this process, is sending out a preferred alternative to the public to focus their attention on. I know the committee, in speaking with the chair and reviewing the minutes from the meeting, or the summary from the meeting, I know the committee did a lot of that, and that's good. I would hope that the council doesn't spend a lot of time revisiting decisions that were made by the committee, but rather focuses on making sure that the document is as complete as it can be, as clear as it can be, and as usable as can be, and that we focus on maintaining the timeline that we have before us so that we can put this document to the public and meet our timeline, so that in May of 2010, the industry won't be under an interim rule or a court-ordered management plan, but rather under a plan that this council has crafted through many meetings, through a tremendous amount of comment, and what I believe, thoughtful consideration. This isn't a perfect plan by any means, but this plan represents a transition that the council identified it was willing to undertake, a transition away from input control dominated fisheries towards output management. We did pass a motion that said we were going to start that in Amendment 16, and we also said that we were going to continue that in Amendment 17 in Groundfish. We're on record saying that. This plan is also significant in that it's going to put ACLs and AMs into place in this fishery. That's a very significant event. We've debated that back and forth since the passage of Magnuson. There's also consideration of sector allocations beyond the two that currently exist in a more holistic way, allocating all stocks to people that self-select into sectors. There's a lot of discussion and details to be worked out about how common pool and sectors interrelate. We'll get into that. There's issues with recreational fisheries, as always, in this amendment. We have alternatives to address those as well. But these decisions represent a significant change in course from my perspective. Again, it's not a complete change, but it is a change in course. And I would urge the council again to consider strongly identifying preferred alternatives so that the public has something to focus its attentions and comments on. It helps guide the public through the document. It is a significant document. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As my earlier comments, the documents that we will use today are behind tab number three. Probably the most important documents will be document number one, which is an abbreviated Amendment 16 draft, or document number four, which is the complete Amendment 16 document on disk. Also, document number 14 is the decision document, which can be used to guide us to and through the votes that we need to take today. On document number 14, there are the sections that refer back to Amendment 16 and the page numbers of where that information will come from. Tom and I will be going back and forth, as we have done in the past, trying to get these votes completed by the council. As indicated in the Groundfish report, the Groundfish Committee and the PDT have continued to meet to work on the development of Amendment 16, and we all know that there have been, as we discussed this morning, a bunch of distractions. It has been my hope and effort to try and keep the committee as focused as possible on Amendment 16. As John said, this is the first step in an effort by this council to move towards output controls. And it's a beginning of that journey down that road. So some of it is new, today, again, we are presenting items that have been developed or language that has been revised that requires the council's approval to be included in the draft document for public hearings. I will say it now. I'll reiterate it again. We are not making any final decisions today. We're just trying to get a document out for public comment and using that public comment to ultimately make our final decisions. As we move through the decision document, some of the alternatives may have language revisions that need approval, and some alternatives have preferred alternatives selected. We will vote on these in order, but we're trying to go through it so that we're through section by section, and once we're done with that, then we move on to the next one. Some of the document, not some, quite a bit, or the vast majority of this document has already been approved by this council. It's not my intent to re-harrow that ground again today. What will be presented are things that need new motions that need to be included in the document. And after we've covered all of the alternatives that need to be included, then we are going to have to take an overall vote to have the document moved out to public hearing. I don't need to reiterate it. Everyone is aware that we're already one council meeting behind our original timeline schedule. And in order to stay on that schedule and make the ultimate deadline the 1st of May 2010, we need to complete our work on the Amendment 16 document today. With that, Tom, before I make the first motion under that Section 4.1, you have a short presentation on that?
I do. I have just a very quick overview. Today, the council is going to take another look at the draft Amendment 16, hopefully make sure it meets council intent and approve it to send it out to public hearing. You've got in your binder, I believe, a paper copy of the draft management measures. You were also, I think, all mailed a CD-ROM copy of the draft amendment. There should not be any significant differences between the management measures and the two documents, and I believe all the page numbers match up as well. The reason I say that is because the management measures that you're looking at should be identical to what the committee looked at their committee meeting. It does not include or incorporate any changes made by the committee. because we had to mail this thing out to you before the committee, well, same day that the committee met. The amendment, okay. The amendment contents, as the chair has said, highlights just a couple of the main points. It revises mortality targets for our rebuilding programs, incorporates the requirements for ACLs and AMs. I think a big part of the document is revisions to sector policies and a general expansion of the sector approach for management of groundfish. It includes several options for revising the effort controls designed to meet the new mortality targets. And there is a kind of, as is typical, there's a grab bag of other things in there that are designed to modify reporting requirements, leasing, transfer, permit, holding a limited access permit between scallop and groundfish boats, a number of other things. For the most part, when I made the presentation as of last Thursday or Friday, we felt that most of the measures were complete in the document with the exception of Atlantic wolffish EFH. I'll get into more detail about wolffish EFH when we get to that spot in the document. I guess you could question, given the letter we got from the service yesterday morning or Friday evening, whether that's still true because a pollock rebuilding trajectory is not included in the document should the council decide to include a rebuilding plan for pollock. With respect to the analysis of the impacts in the draft CD-ROM, we're still working on analyzing the impacts of the document. For the most part, the protected species and EFH impacts are complete. Most of the biological impacts are complete. We are still editing that, and a good part of the economic impacts. Your document does not have any social community impacts in it. That's still in development. And there's a lot of summaries and summation that hasn't been done. Typically, we like to go through and compare the different alternatives in summary sections, and we haven't done that yet. So there's still a considerable amount of work that needs to be done. I think I need to highlight the main analytic challenge for analyzing the measures in this document is the big question of who is going to participate in sectors. This impacts not only the design of effort controls, but also analyzing those controls. We really don't know how many boats are going to decide to join sectors and what groups of boats those may be. Another big unknown, of course, is that we don't really know what the interim action is going to do, and we don't really know how this Framework 42 court order will be resolved and what impacts that may have on fishing in 2009, which, of course, could lead to questions about what the amendment needs to do for fishing year 2010 and into the future. I think the next steps are pretty simple. The review today of the DEIS, we need to complete and expand the analyses I talked about. We expect that we'll be able to get that done over roughly the next month or so, which should enable us to get out to public hearing sometime in late April or during the month of May in that time frame, and come back for a final council decision on the amendment in June of 2009, which I think is the meeting is the third week of June, if I recall. We would then submit and hope for implementation by May 1st of 2010. Now, that's a very quick overview. That's really all I had intended to go over. I'd be pleased to answer any questions on that overview. If there are specific questions on management measures, it might be better to wait and talk about them as we work through the decision document, but I leave that up to the committee chair.
Questions for Tom? Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, Tom, with one of the analytical challenges that you cited here is the unknown sector membership, complicating effort control design, impacts analysis, all of that. It's a challenge, but it's a challenge that can be handled, I assume. You're confident that we can actually get through the analysis and have something to act on or bring to public hearing based on that analysis?
Well, it's described in more detail in the analytics sections. We can put together a document. We can analyze impacts. I think you just got to recognize that those impacts are not as certain as they would be if we knew exactly who is going to be in sectors. When we, and this is discussed in the impact section as well, when we design the effort controls and we analyze the impacts of the effort controls, we basically assume that nobody joins a sector. There's an untested belief on the PDT that sector membership could influence your design of effort controls. but we have not been able to figure out a rational way to test that theory or to figure out how to account for it while we're designing the effort controls. It seems to make sense to us, for example, that if every large boat that fishes offshore on George's Bank yellowtail flounder joins a sector, well, then the effort control design might be very different than if all those boats don't join a sector. But we don't really have any way of predicting how that influences the effort control design or how that influences our analysis of impacts, except to say that it makes it uncertain.
Anything else? Rip.
Tom, in our discussion this morning of some of the issues in the letter from the service, I can't remember whether we were going to include those as we went through this or come back at the end and address those.
I'm not sure we decided either. It might be easier if the service tries to highlight those as we step through the document, if we're going to walk through the document.
Okay, because the first one is under section 4.2, which we actually did not have any action on that, but that is where we would do something on pollock. We do have a motion concerning wolffish later on. So I don't know if we do not have a committee motion that, and again, since we got this, I saw my first copy of it yesterday, we would need to have a motion to include a rebuilding program for pollock.
Yeah. We received official notice Friday afternoon that pollock was overfished based on the results of the fall 2008 fall survey. Pollock was overfished as of 2007. The PDT did do some preliminary work. I just got an email a few minutes ago from the Science Center representative on the PDT providing the pollock rebuilding trajectories or possible pollock rebuilding trajectories. They work out to needing about a 58% reduction in exploitation in order to rebuild pollock by 10 years, I think 2020, if I recall. And it works out to a similar number but slightly higher if you decide you want to rebuild pollock by 2017. The PDT does have some concerns about the index-based projections that are used for pollock. In some instances, they give us completely irrational results. And so that makes us question to a certain extent how valid these projections are. And I say that, but don't interpret that to mean the projections are calling for too large a reduction in exploitation. I mean, it's just as possible that it may be the opposite. But I also point out that this is the same projection model that's been used for index-based stocks since about Amendment 13. So, the PDT's concerns, I think, should be noted, but I think we got to do more work before we can say anything about whether those projections approach should be replaced or not. So I think the question before the council here is whether to include a rebuilding program for pollock in Amendment 16, and then whether to, what time period to try and use. We have one alternative that I believe meets the reduction, about a 60% reduction in exploitation for pollock. The other two, I suspect, would fall short. I say I suspect because we have to evaluate them in the context of all the measures in the amendment, but I don't, my own personal belief is that those two alternatives will probably still fall short of a 60% reduction in exploitation.
Does anybody, David?
Yeah, pollock is a transboundary stock. I mean, I'll make that statement. Pollock is a transboundary stock. It spends the summer in Canadian waters and the winter over here, or the fall and the early winter. So if Is that 60% reduction a 60% reduction across the transboundary region, or is it 60% reduction of the American portion of the catch? What does it equate to?
Well, it's not part of the official understanding that we have right now. We're not co-managing pollock, although I believe we've requested to... it's scheduled on the track, but it's not part of an official understanding right now.
Well, the reason I ask this is if we set some kind of rebuilding trajectory and we drastically curtail the pollock fishery on this side of the line and it's business as usual on the other side of the line, once again, we're taking the full hit for something we don't even have 50% control over. And I just, I raised this issue early because I think it's, we've got to wrestle that to the ground right off the bat. I really hate to see American fishermen once again taking the hit when it's business as usual somewhere else.
So what's your suggestion, Dave?
Well, my suggestion at the moment would be, given that we got this letter on Friday, is that we leave pollock out of Amendment 16, that we get on with the transboundary aspects of it in the meantime, and come to a solution, a mutually agreeable solution with the Canadians as to how we're going to manage them before we decide what cuts have to be made on the American side of the line.
That seems like a reasonable suggestion, except I think we're required to take action within 1 year of this letter. So that would be February 2 years? Further discussion? Jim?
Yeah, I'd just like clarification on when are we supposed to take action after receiving a letter? Is it 1 year or 2 years or 19 months? Or can somebody give me a clarification on that? Appreciate it. Thank you.
Within 2 years after identification under paragraph one, I'm reading right from the Act. Sorry. The appropriate council shall prepare and implement a fishery management plan amendment or to end overfishing immediately in the fishery and to rebuild affected stocks of fish or to prevent overfishing from occurring in a case where it's not overfished. So it's within 2 years after receiving notification.
So that would have to happen through an amendment, Gene? Not through a framework?
Yes.
Okay. So that...
Oh, yeah, that's... All right. Doug reminds me this is... this part has been delayed. The effectiveness of this statute or this provision has been delayed till July 2009 when Congress passed this act. So
that means we have till July of 2011. It doesn't take effect.
No, then you have, if you're under the old system, it's 1 year, I believe. Now the problem is this is not a named fishery in the FMP yet. This provision applies to stocks of fish that are named fisheries, named stocks. Oh, this is pollock? I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about wolffish.
Somebody?
Didn't somebody just mention wolffish? I'm trying to...
Yes, we did mention wolffish, but right now we're talking about pollock. It's 1 year, but the Act changed it, did revise the language, but as Gene and Doug had pointed out, that's not effective till after July. But it's not significantly different because they also revised the language. Before it was the council had to submit within 1 year. Now it says submit and implement. So there's not a big difference between the old and the new language.
Okay, so that means we have to submit within 1 year?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a, not a committee motion, but I would make a motion that we include Pollock Rebuilding Program in Amendment 16, since it's basically going to be the only vehicle by which we can meet the timeline.
Is there a second? Seconded by Pat Kirkle. Discussion? Doug?
What does that do to the timeline of this amendment? If we're scheduled to go out to approve this document today, to go out to public hearing, what kind of delay in including Pollock would result from that?
I'd have to ask Tom that question, but initial analysis, as Tom had indicated, was done by the PDT, because there was at least some early indication that the fall survey would come in at a level that would require inclusion of it. But I'm not sure all of the information and data got to them until just recently.
Well, the rebuilding plan is relatively simple to insert into the document. That doesn't take too long, or the options for the rebuilding plan, should the council decide to have more than one option for the rebuilding plan. I think the big question is whether two of the alternatives for effort controls need to be modified to try and get closer to the reduction in exploitation that is needed for Pollock. I can't speak to that. I told you earlier that my suspicion is that they will need to be modified, but I'm just not sure how much. Dave Gaethel raised a point with respect to the transboundary nature of the stock that might influence that analysis slightly, but I would point out that the way this particular stock is assessed, about 90% of it is caught by U.S. fishermen. There is some catch on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 metric tons in the past, but less than 1,000 metric tons recently that goes into the assessment that's caught by Canadians. So, you know, if you account for that, that reduces perhaps the restrictions that need to be done on our side by a little bit, and I would have to evaluate the alternative. So, you know, the question is whether, you know, you need to modify those two alternatives a lot, and whether they need to be, you know, that affects a whole lot of things, because if they do need to be modified, that completely changes all our economic impact analysis for those two alternatives and takes considerable amount of effort to redo.
Jim.
Thanks. Just for your information, I wanted to say that when the stock has been assessed, as Tom indicated, they've used an index-based assessment, and the intention, the next time this is assessed, in June of 2010, roughly, the center intends for this to move to an analytical age-based assessment. So that will be more inclusive, include more types of data. I can't predict at all if that will affect the outcome, the science information that you get. But just so you know that when that assessment is done, a major change in the modeling approach is planned.
Dr. Pierce.
Well, I think Jim just addressed my concern. I'm very glad to hear what you said, Jim, that there'll be an effort at the center to go to some other way of assessing Pollock. Clearly, what we've got right now is not very satisfying, since the letter indicates that, you know, the overfishing threshold to determine overfished is 1 kilogram per tow, and now we're 0.9 kilograms per tow, so we're below the threshold by tenth of a kilogram, which is about 2/10 of a pound. So we have to take this action in part because of 2/10 of a pound. It's the same problem we have with other index-based stocks. We're wrestling with that, and as long as the center is still working on this approach to shift us over to analytical assessments, then that it takes away some of the concern. Thanks for that clarification, Jim.
Doug.
I'll try to clarify my question a little bit more. If we approve this motion, are we going to have to delay the approval of this entire document to go out to public hearing? Are we going to have to wait for the analysis, have a committee meeting, an oversight committee meeting, and then bring it back to the council and at our next meeting in April? Or is there a process where if we include this in here, and assuming we're not going to do have to revise any of the management measures on that assumption, that we could move this document forward just with this in and have the analysis done. Is that clear?
I know what you're asking. I don't know that I can answer it. Tom, do you have any sense of that, Tom? I mean, I think you kind of already answered it, but...
Well, flying blind here a little bit on this one. I mean, what I would like to say is, you know, push this out the door and work on the modifications to it as we go forward, noting in the document for the public that it's possible that additional measures will be needed to achieve the Pollock rebuilding target. I'm just not sure whether that can be done or not, because someone may argue the public doesn't really know what's going to be presented. And once again, this illustrates the problem of not knowing who's going to be in sectors, because, you know, the reality is that this Pollock issue isn't a concern if most of the fishery – Pollock issue isn't a concern. What I mean by that is the design of effort controls is not a concern if it turns out that 90% of the fishery winds up in sectors. The design of those effort controls is not much of a problem, as much of a problem as if nobody winds up in sectors. You know, then they have to be addressed right. I mean, so – you know, I think there's two possible ways to approach this. One is you say, okay, you know, we're going to send it forward. We're going to give the committee the authority to modify those two effort controls so that they do achieve the Pollock rebuilding objective. The other approach is to say we're going to go out to the public and tell them that we think additional measures may be required and then work on that during the time period, and then when we get to the final step, incorporate that. There's a little bit of a precedent for the latter approach in the development of Amendment 13, where, if you recall, when we took the draft Amendment 13 document out to the public, we did not know what reference points the council was going to choose. And in that document, we highlighted that some of the management measures could be modified depending on what the final decision was made on the reference points. That made it, of course, very difficult for the public to figure out what the heck was going to happen. But we did go out to the public that way on that amendment.
Dave.
I understand what Doug's saying, and I understand what everybody's saying here, but this is a pretty important subject, especially for New Hampshire. I mean, about the only reason for most of our boats left to exist is to catch pollock. They're mostly gillnetters, and they catch mostly pollock. And, you know, if they go to the public hearings, they're going to want to comment on the pollock measures. So, I mean, I don't really know how to proceed here. I don't think you can go to public hearing with a document that doesn't have the measures in it. By the same token, I don't think you can meet the one-year deadline if you don't go to public hearing with this document. So, you know, you're caught between a rock and a legal challenge here, basically. Somebody's going to challenge you if you don't do something in a year from one side, and somebody may challenge you that they didn't have an adequate chance to comment at the public hearings from the other side if you don't provide what the alternatives to rebuild Pollock are going to look like. So, you know, I can't belittle this discussion. This is an 11th hour thing that I would prefer to put off into a separate document so that the public is given the measures and given adequate time to comment on them, and also in the hopes that in the intervening time, this transboundary group will weigh in, that we'll have some discussion of models. Perhaps the Canadians don't model things the same way we do. I don't know if they use an index. I don't know what they use, because I wasn't expecting this to appear today. I didn't do any research on it. You know, I know we have instances where the Canadians and the American scientists don't agree on how to model things, and we have to come to some kind of a consensus. So there's an awful lot that goes into this that would, to me, be best served by putting it into Amendment 17. And I don't know if all the rationale that's just been provided is adequate to avoid a legal challenge if that takes more than a year or not. But that would be my preference.
Pat Kirkham.
Well, I disagree with the characterization of this as an 11th hour change. We knew from when the GARM results were released that there was a very good possibility that you'd need to include a rebuilding program for Pollock. The committee's talked about it. The council's talked about it. We were waiting for the survey results, but we all pretty much knew what the survey results were going to show. So I don't think, you know, we can reasonably argue that this is unexpected in any way. And, you know, frankly, none of those reasons do exempt us from the one-year deadline requirement. I think the only way that we're going to be able to do this is in Amendment 16. I think there is one option that might meet the rebuilding objectives for Pollock in the draft amendment now, but I think you'd probably want to make sure that the other options were viable options by making sure that they also met the rebuilding targets. So I wondered if the committee had talked about what kind of measures might be included to address the Pollock situation.
The answer is we did not address them.
Well, anything further from the council? I don't like putting things off. I'm not sure. Seems one of the problems we have, as Tom stated twice now, is not knowing who's going to be in a sector under a hard tack of Pollock complicates our ability to craft a management plan for Pollock for the common pool. That's one of the issues we have. It's not unique to Pollock. But here we are talking about Pollock and trying to decide if we're going to put it in the plan. Is it possible to put it in the amendment, put it out to public comment, and decide not to include it in the amendment and be forced to do a real quick and dirty action afterwards once we know who's in the sectors to follow up? I'm just thinking on my feet here. I just don't know. I understand the hesitation, but is it possible once we know who's in the sectors to then do a Pollock action because we know what corrective course we have to take for the common pool? Because we know who's in the common pool, we know who's in the sectors. Does that work timeline-wise? Why don't I suggest that we table this until we get through some other issues? Get a head of steam going, and we'll take a break or two throughout the rest of the day, and hopefully we can have caucus and think this through. I don't think we're going to come to a resolution right now. So I'd entertain a motion to table. Seconded. Doug Grout. All those in favor? Thirteen. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. Motion's tabled. Rip.
Okay, we will move on to the first committee motion. The first committee motion, the committee recommends. Sorry, Tom.
I might have missed this, but in the services letter on section 4.2, they also talk about Atlantic wolffish. I don't know if. We're going to talk about wolffish later, but I think this is in the context of a rebuilding program. I just want to point out that we cannot calculate a rebuilding trajectory for Atlantic wolffish. The advice from the Data Poor Working Group was pretty specific on that point and said don't do projections with these results. So in the terms of generating a rebuilding trajectory for wolffish, we can't do it. And so the approach that we've taken is to try and reduce fishing mortality as close to zero as is practicable, I think. And we'll get into that in later discussions of wolffish measures and adding the discussion of whether to add wolffish to the management unit or not.
Tom, along the same line, do you have any of the same sort of comments on the Gulf of Maine winter flounder?
Well, yes, I have almost the same comment, though the language was not quite as clear in the GARM 3 report. I believe, if I look it up, that they also expressed serious concerns about using those results for management advice. If you give me 2 seconds, I can read that to you. Further, the panel noted that given the problems encountered, the panel agreed that none of the models put forth gave a clear picture of the status of the resource. Further, the panel noted that until these issues were resolved, the proposed analysis could not be used to provide management advice nor stock projections. So, you know, the service has recommended that we develop a rebuilding program for Gulf of Maine winter flounder, and we've got the scientific advice from the GARM panel review that says the analysis they used should not be used that way. Approach that we've taken here is that many of our management measures, of course, are going to reduce mortality on Gulf of Maine winter flounder considerably, but we haven't actually adopted what we would call a formal rebuilding program that includes a timeline and target fishing mortality rate and that type of thing.
Without any other comments, I think that we will move on to section 4.3, fishery program administration. The first committee motion relates to page 63 in the document. It's a committee motion. When setting ACLs, the council will establish management uncertainty by such user groups as sectors, party charter, recreational, and common pool.
Discussion on the committee motion. No discussion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council, ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous.
Page 65, committee motion.
Tom.
I apologize for interrupting the chair again, but while we're on page 63, if you look in the back of the letter from NIMS on the amendment attachment on page 8, I believe it is, there's a paragraph that refers to this section that I just want to highlight. Administrative process for setting multi-species ACLs. And there's some suggested language from the regional office that was worked on with various staffs, including me. Kind of a weird way to put it. They just want to clarify exactly what information the groundfish PDT will use when we develop the ACL recommendations. I'm not convinced we really need a motion. This seems to be a relatively minor point, but we just want to highlight it. And if any council members object, then perhaps we need a motion. But it seems like it should be relatively simple to incorporate this. This language here is really intended just to clarify that we're not going to try and do a GARM every other year, you know, and that these are the types of data that will be used as we try and set the ACL process.
Is there any objection to clarifying the language in the document? Is it illustrated on page 8? Okay. Thanks, Tom. Rip.
Okay, page 65, committee motion. The committee recommends that the items in the PDT report section 11A, B, and C be discussed in the ACL section of Amendment 16. This item refers to a motion from the December committee meeting that can be found if you want to look at it in document number 2.
Discussion on the motion? Pat Kirkle.
Yeah, it's actually our opinion that this language conflicts with the biennial adjustment. Then in a lot of ways it's unnecessary and it may not be possible timing-wise. So we would recommend not including it.
Pat, can you just point me to what language you're referring to?
The highlighted text on page 65, and in particular the A, B, and C.
Okay. Tom Neese.
Since this got started by something in a PDT report, maybe I can give the council a little background and they'll understand why the committee inserted it in here. You know, the issue always comes up, what do you do if you exceed an ACL in year one? How does that affect what goes on with your ACLs in year two, particularly if you're setting your ACLs every other year? And, you know, I think the tendency is you think of this very simply. You say, well, if there's an overage of an ACL in year one, you deduct it off of year two. Well, the problem with that is that we've got, you know, that is in some venues is appealing, but the problem to that is that in our structure, we're going to have sub-ACLs. And so it's not necessarily the case that if you have an ACL overage in 1 year that you've somehow affected the stock in a way that you need a deduction in year two. And you might, but the other problem is if you do need a deduction, there's no guarantee that the overage that you went over is enough of a deduction. You may actually have done enough damage to the stock that you need more of a payback. And so, you know, we highlighted these issues, I think, to the committee, and we didn't really have a good solution for them because of the timing. But the committee felt that these types of issues should be discussed when we're talking about ACLs, so that's how we got it put in here. I mean, the PDT, when we mentioned this, we recognized that, you know, you've got a problem with trying to evaluate this and make a change in a timely fashion because you can't get it done. And if it's automatic, it may not be the right amount. So, you know, I think that's kind of how this wound up here. And I think what the service is saying is, look, you know, why write this in here when you can't make a change in a timely fashion? You'll incorporate those types of problems, A, into setting the ACLs and setting that at the right level, and B, when you set your ACLs the next time around, they'll have to take into account any overages that occurred. I think that's what they're saying.
Dr. Pierce.
Right, I don't pretend to exactly understand both sides here. However, Pat, if I could ask you a question. I think you said that C, particularly A, B, and C, should be removed from the document. And C is very appealing to me especially. That is, the council may adjust subcomponent ACLs so that to the extent practicable, components not responsible for the overage are not subject to reductions in their ACL and result in changes in fishing opportunities. Are you objecting to that particular strategy, or are you suggesting a different process be used that would still enable us to follow through with the intent of C?
No, I'm not objecting to C. C is actually already in the document somewhere else. It's more the process that talks about how you get to that that I think conflicts with the biennial adjustment.
Jamala.
Yeah, that was going to be my comment, was that I thought we had this C somewhere else in the document. So now, realizing that, I'm going to make a motion that we eliminate on page 65 option A, B, and C.
Is there a second? Seconded by David Pierce. Discussion? Dave Gathel.
Yeah, to Pat, actually, I'm still confused with how this interferes with the biannual adjustment.
Well, this is a process that takes place in between the biennial adjustment, and there's not really time to do it in between the biennial adjustment. So you can't do both, really. And this one, by the time you get through this process, you're almost to the point again where you're doing the biennial adjustment. It's just implemented too late.
Okay, so it's an issue of timing then more than anything else. There just isn't enough time to make this adjustment before the biannual adjustment comes up anyway. That makes sense. Now I'm beginning to understand where we're going here.
Tom Mason?
Yeah, I just want to caution. I think the section that people are referring to with respect to item C might be the language in the sector discussion, which talks about how, you know, tries to protect the common pool if the sectors go over, or the sectors if the common pool goes over. I'm not sure whether this language is really anywhere else and applies to other components of the ACL that exist. So if it doesn't, I just ask your leave to make sure that, you know, that if the council wants that type of language in here, at least subparagraph C stays in. I'm not convinced that's anywhere else without hunting through the document.
Jamala?
Yeah, I think it's an important component to have this section in this document somewhere, but I'm not sure it's under it should be under this heading. Maybe it should be. So having heard that from Tom, then I would like to amend my motion, subject to the seconder's friendly adjustment, to eliminate C from the motion and keep C in, so that precisely this happens, that different sectors and the open pool, they're all responsible for any overages to the extent practical. So,
you mean eliminate A and B, but leave C?
Yeah, eliminate C from the motion.
Okay.
To amend.
Seconder agrees, so it's been changed so that we eliminate options A and B only, leaving C in place. Pat Kirkel?
Just a question. Don't object to that, but didn't the motion we just pass cover this? I mean, maybe I'm confused, but the motion we had that said that when setting the ACLs, they'll establish management uncertainty by user groups such as sectors, party charter, recreational common pool. I guess you're not reading that to mean necessarily that you'd make make them responsible under the ACL. Okay.
On the motion to amend, anything from the council? Anything from the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor on the motion to amend, raise your hand. Unanimous. 17. Tom Mies.
Since we're on this section.
Yeah. Tom, this is now the main motion as amended.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. Anything further on the main motion as amended? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous, 17. Okay. Tom.
I'm going to refer to another item in the NIMS letter directly above this one, which refers to annual catch limit subcomponents. And I think what this paragraph is suggesting is that the ACLs for yellowtail flounder should be in the scallop fishery should be specified in Amendment 16. Our intent for all ACLs that are required by Amendment 16 is to submit a specs package for these this fall and not to incorporate them into the actual amendment document. I believe that's on the council's timeline as planned. The reason is that we won't really know, there's a couple reasons why we want to do yellowtail that way for the scallop fishery, but one of the reasons is that we want to make sure we know what the council has adopted when we set the ACLs.
Pat?
Well, that's true for actually setting the poundage for the ACLs, but the document does include the percentage allocation, this document, and that's what needs to be in there for the scallop as well.
Tom?
No, with respect to scallops, what we proposed is because of the uncertainty that we do that as part of the specs package process and that we not hardwire a percentage in there because the concern is that with scallop rotational management, we can't really hardwire a number into our amendment document that's fixed over a time period because the council may want the flexibility, I suspect would want the flexibility, to adjust the yellowtail that's allocated to the scallop fishery based on where we think the scallop fishery is going to take place for the next couple of years. And so when we talk about the ACL setting process for scallops, at the top of page 65, it talks about not specifying a specific value for the ACL, but to determining that as part of the biannual adjustment process, and pretty much for the reasons that I mentioned, because we want to be able to take into account the specific elements of scallop rotational management when we determine those ACLs.
Okay, we're going to move on to page 67, Wolffish. Committee motion to include Wolffish in Amendment 16. And I believe, although it's not stated in the motion, it was the intent to include the status determination and the essential fish habitat in that as part of that motion.
So it wasn't an official commitment. I should have to add that on there. That's what's intended by the motion.
Tom?
Yeah, what this motion means is that we would incorporate Wolffish into the management unit for regulated for northeast multi-species. I didn't want to use the wrong word there. And that would adopt the status determination criteria, which I've already written into the document, which came out of the DataPOR working group meeting. We would also have to define EFH. This creates a little bit of a problem because the EFH options are not in front of you right now. But I think Chad Demarest is behind me, and he can explain the work that the Habitat Committee has the Habitat Tech Team working on EFH for Atlantic Wolffish. These are all required elements in the amendment in order to add this to the management unit. If we don't include all of this stuff in the amendment and add it to the management unit, then we cannot take action under this amendment to try and reduce mortality on Wolffish. So, looking for Chad. Well, okay. Maybe you can just round it out a little bit. I'm not real clear what the alternatives were that the tech team was tasked with.
The committee tasked the text. Basically, the committee had to decide what the method for defining EFH would be, both in the text descriptions and in the mapping. And the two options that the committee considered were basically consistent with the 1998 Omnibus 1 methodology or consistent with Omnibus 2, Phase 1. And the committee tasked the PDT with developing EFH for Wolffish consistent with Omnibus 2, Phase 1. Pretty logical conclusion. So the PDT, as soon as we're done with what we're working on right now with phase two. In a couple of weeks, we're going to go back and do what the committee asked us to do, which is gin up some maps and text descriptions for Atlantic wolffish.
And then once the Habitat Committee buys off on that, then we would insert it into the document prior to submission. There is some draft text in your binder that Chad prepared that, you know, does everything but put in the actual maps, I think.
It doesn't even do that much, but we're getting there.
Jamala?
No, just a comment that their essential fish habitat, whatever they develop, will be inserted in the document, and it'll be out for public comment so that the public will be able to comment on that finding, I guess. That's part of the process, right?
Anything further from the council? In the audience, back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Sixteen, unanimous. You're on a roll, Rip.
Okay, Tom, were there any other insertions before we get to the PSC?
I don't think so, but...
Okay. Page 72, potential sector contribution calculations. Committee motion to recommend to the council not to pick a preferred alternative for the PSC allocation issue and to send this section forward to the public as is.
Committee motion, discussion? Any discussion from the council? Jim Oblin?
Well, just, you know, to put it out there, we've discussed this exact thing several times here, even at the council level, and it have been operating that we would send this out without a preferred right along. So this is just a continuation of that discussion that we've had right along.
What else on the council? Dave Gethel.
Yeah, I support the motion because I think people need as much time as possible to figure out what their potential landings are. I would like to get it on the record to kind of caution people that they really ought to look over their landing records before commenting on this, on these alternatives, because the people that have looked over their landing records have found errors in them. Some are substantial, some aren't. It's, you know, I'm not trying to place fault with anybody. Some of the errors of, you know, maybe transcriptions, they may be dealer errors, they may be service errors. We don't know where the errors are, but there are errors. And so when you comment on an allocation scheme, one of the alternatives, you ought to know what it is exactly that you're going to have. I'm also hoping that in the interim time between when we put this document out and when we actually go to public hearing, that more catch histories will be released, that more people will be able to see what permits they may have bought that they haven't been able to get the catch histories from, have for histories, so that, again, they'll be able to comment more holistically on the options here. They're not as straightforward as it may seem. You know, people, once they look at their histories, may revise their thinking about what kind of allocation scheme they want. So I think that with this particular option, as controversial as it is, and with as much information still unknown, the best thing to do is to let people get their information and then comment. Thank you.
Rip.
Thank you. As I mentioned during the last committee meeting, I don't personally happen to feel it would be a bad thing to have a preferred alternative for people to take aim at and then to make some comparisons. What you're saying to people is, if we took the vote today on the final measures, this is likely what we would pick. And then the public can say, well, no, I don't like that one for certain reasons. Now, and maybe they have to do it anyway, but now they have to go and look at five alternatives and compare all five of those and see how it comes out. So I don't think it's a bad position for us to have something for the public to really to focus on and to comment, and we can certainly change our mind back on the final vote.
What else in the council? Terry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm having a hard time with this one. We talked about this at length well over a year ago, and at that point I thought I had an educated thought about what I might select, but a lot of time's gone by. The issues have gone by, and I'm feeling uncomfortable about picking a preferred alternative. There's several. I mean, there are two basic concepts in there, and I think the industry needs to tease it apart. And I'd personally feel best about hearing from the industry what they think is going to work best for them, and deal with it after the public comment period.
Doug.
Yeah, I support this motion because I'd like to hear from the public what they want, not necessarily what they don't want. I'd like to hear the positive aspects of this, and I'm afraid if we put up a bullseye around one of the options, you may hear more about what they don't want.
Anyone else on the council? Frank?
I think it's just as important to hear what they don't want and the reasons they don't want it. I think we should have a preferred. I really don't have a dog in this fight, but I think we should have a preferred, and I think people will comment more if you have one, because right now you have to comment on all five, and you're probably going to have to comment all five either way. But we're going to have to make this decision, and if it comes back and we have 100 comments and 20 of them for each one, we're no better off than we are now, because you're going to have them all over the board, and it's going to depend on, basically right now it depends on where you fall on these, on which one you're going to support. And like I know people are saying they're not sure where they fall on these based on their landings history or whatnot, but I really think we should pick one. I made that statement I think about a year ago, and I think we should.
Dr. Pearson.
Sure, it's always good to pick a preferred, but if anybody offers up a motion for a preferred, that's going to result in about 2 hours worth of discussion, and we haven't got that kind of time. So even though the preferred sometimes makes a great deal of sense, I suggest that we just pass this motion as is and get the public comment on what they feel we should do.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Jackie?
Jackie O'Dell, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Although I understand the rationale for picking a preferred, I just want the council to know that if I had to pick a preferred right now or make a recommendation to our over 500 vessels that are permit holders that are on our roster, I would be unable to do so. So, you know, we're still in the process of gathering data, landings data, for our members that are on our roster, and I think that people will be getting that data over the next few months, and they should have the information in hand to know what these different allocation formulas and considerations mean for them. So, again, I appreciate the understanding of why to pick a preferred, but I would recommend not doing so right now because I wouldn't be able to do so if we had to as an organization right now. Thank you.
Eric?
Eric Hess, Fishing Vessel Tenacious. I'd like to see the council pick a preferred alternative. I'm sensitive to what Dr. Pierce said. Maybe even just a straw poll would give people an idea of how the council might be leaning. You've had 15 months to consider the issues here, and you've probably had more information than anybody else in the industry to do it. It seems to me as leaders and representatives of the industry, you should be prepared at this point to make your opinions known. This is probably the single most important part of this document in terms of how the fishery looks going forward for the next few years. I'd add one other thing. When we cut days at sea several years ago now, I think the criteria that was used or that was relied on was it will never be a use-it-or-lose-it scenario. And, in fact, it was a use-it-or-lose-it scenario. People's days at sea were based on their fishing history. So you already have a precedent there. And unless you make some other statement now, that's all that people have to go on, that they lost what they didn't use before. So it looks like you're leaning towards fishing history now. Again, I'd like to see at least take a straw poll or better yet, pick a preferred alternative. Thanks.
Anyone else? Aaron?
Aaron Doherty, Penobscot East Resource Center. I think that if you pick a preferred alternative, that the public will probably focus on that and not give due consideration to others. So for that reason, I think that you shouldn't, because I think that the more wide open it is, the better, because you do want a wide range of opinions. You know, I think the public, like the last speaker said, I think that their inclination is to look more at catch history because that's what past decisions have been based on. But I think that, you know, you do have a range of alternatives there, and I think you want the public to take a look at all of them and consider them all seriously. Thanks.
Anyone else? Mike?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Russo. I'd like to see you pick a preferred alternative. You know, I've been weighing all the options for Chris almost, you know, 2 years now. We got all the data. You know, we know what the options are. We've had 15 months. It's from a fisherman's perspective. I've looked at every 8 ways from Sunday here. Let's get on with it. You know, I'd like to see what the council thinks, and we'll comment. I mean, you can still comment on things that weren't picked as a preferred alternative. There may be valid arguments that need consideration, but I really like to see the council come up with a preferred. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Anything further from the council? So we'll wait till June to announce how the allocation is going to work. That's when we'll make our decision. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? 13. Opposed? 4. Motion carries 13-4.
The next item, page 76, this is just to bring it to your attention. This is under mortality conservation controls. By consensus, the committee directed staff to modify the language in that section so the ground fish sector vessels catch was not double counted. We don't need to take any action on that. I just wanted to bring it to people's attention. The next motion is under monitoring requirements, page 80, committee motion. When calculating discard rates for trips conducted by members of the groundfish sectors, the actual discard rate will be calculated for any and all trips for which observer coverage is provided by either the sectors or the New England Fisheries Science Center observer program, provided such coverage is for the duration of the entire trip.
Discussion? Anyone on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Anything? Tom Neese.
Yeah,
I just want to make the same comment I made at the committee. It's not clear to me whether this causes some concerns with how observer data is used to estimate discards. And I had hoped to be able to talk to folks at the center who are more attuned to that than I am, and I didn't get a chance to do that. Now, I'd had some preliminary conversations last fall with Paul Rago where he said he did not think this was a concern at all, but I just wanted to confirm that.
One of the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. In favor, opposed, abstentions, one abstention. The motion carries 16-0 with one abstention. Rip.
Page 81, standards for sector monitoring and reporting service providers.
Tom.
Yeah, I'm shuffling back and forth here. I thought the service had a question on this section that they wanted to raise. And that's on page 2 of their letter. And it refers to when determining the assumed discard rate, it states that discards will only be estimated for combinations of species and gear where discards are expected. It's important to note that discards may come from other species, gears, combinations not listed in this table. Therefore, this section as well as section should a different section, probably the one that talks about common pool, should ensure that all mortality from sector participants is accounted for under Amendment 16. Now, the problem with this comment is that I'm not quite sure how to do this. The assumed discard rates apply and are used before we have sufficient observer coverage on board to substitute the observer coverage. And so, you know, the assumed discard rates are based on what we've observed in the fishery before. And it's accurate that we may have discards from another source that we haven't observed before, but it's not clear to me if we haven't observed them before, we'll be able to come up with an assumed discard rate that should be applied to account for them. So it's kind of I kind of get into this circular thing. I mean, I understand what we're trying to do. We're trying to account for all sources of mortality. But I think you got to recall that this whole idea of an assumed discard rate is we're applying something to landings for things that we haven't observed. You know, we're applying a estimate of discards to landings that are not necessarily observed, and it's not clear to me how we come up with a discard estimate for those things. Just as an example, there are on rare occasions, and you'll see them in the database and the observer database, you'll see on rare occasions yellowtail flounder caught by the longline fishery. You'll see one or two. Well, you know, I don't know how we apply, you know, no one ever calculates an assumed discard rate for that. That's kind of how our table was created in another part of the book that says, you know, we're not going to apply assumed discards for yellowtail for a longline because it happens so rarely. And I don't know how we would do that for an assumed discard rate here.
Pat?
The difference is between only calculating them where they're expected and calculating them where they're actually observed. And as long as we are calculating them in those situations where they've been observed, then I think it meets the criteria for taking into consideration all sources of mortality. So maybe this is just something that we can work out staff to staff, and it's a semantic issue, but we're only going to consider discards where they're expected part that's troubling.
I can probably work on that with staff.
Okay. Rip?
Okay. Tom, just we're going to move on to the monitoring. Was there another comment that you wanted to make?
No, I think it'll fit better under your next one.
Okay. All right. Page 81, standards for sector monitoring and reporting service providers. Committee motion that we approve the monitoring standards from the monitoring working group for inclusion in Amendment 16 and to delete the requirement for a bachelor's degree on page 28 and the section on the Fair Labor Standards Act on page 26 of the December version of monitoring standards.
Committee motion, discussion? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Anything from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. The motion carries 16-0. One abstention. Rip.
Tom, comment on the electronic monitoring equipment. Comment.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can. I'm not sure I can find the exact page that I think this comment is appropriate to, but I think it could be page 80, where we talk about levels of observer coverage being 100% or something other than 100%. And there's a line in there about electronic monitoring. And the service's comment that it's unclear who determines the sufficiency of electronic monitoring equipment and the process for determining which EM is allowable for each gear type.
Jamadhan?
Yeah, I'll just keep this moving. I'll make a motion that the National Marine Fisheries Service will approve electronic monitoring that would be allowed, similar to that would be the motion, but it'd be similar to how they approve a VMS vendor.
You want to wordsmith that? Are you telling them they will approve electronic monitoring or?
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to find the place to put this in right now, but that National Marine Fisheries Service will grant approval of electronic monitoring equipment to be used in the monitoring program.
Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Discussion. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that the motion is compatible with or consistent with the bullet that describes this particular concern by the service. In particular, the concern expressed by the service is that they really aren't sure who is going to determine the sufficiency of electronic monitoring equipment, how much is sufficient, and also who is going to determine what type of electronic monitoring system or gear would be, well, what sort of system would be allowable for each individual gear type in the fishery. That's my assumption, right? So with that stated, does your motion address those particular concerns? Or it doesn't seem that it does, but just want to make sure.
Well, that's the intent of the motion, is to have National Marine Fisheries Service be the approver of, I suspect a sector will come forward and say, we want to use X, Y, and Z as an electronic monitoring system. And NIMS will say that's an adequate system or it's an inadequate. And there'll be the normal back and forth of the sector and the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Pat Kirkle.
If that's the process, and I think that's a potential option, then I think that's different than what you're proposing. That really suggests that the sector would need to provide the criteria for use of the electronic monitoring and the sectors that they're proposing. So it would be part of the operations plan, and you know that I think is a potential option here.
Jim Alden.
Okay. What I'm trying to do is respond to the 4.3.3.52 sector monitoring requirements where National Marine Fisheries asks if it's unclear whether the council, NIMS, or a vendor responsibility to approve it. So I'm trying to make it so that NIMS has the authority to pick the to approve the system. That's the equipment.
I think that there are a couple of options. One, we could try to talk about the criteria that we'd use for approving these, but probably the more straightforward way to do this is just to say that any electronic monitoring proposed as part of a sector plan will include the criteria and the sectors. So then, of course, the operations plan come to us and the council, and that's the approval process.
Is that what you had in mind, Jim? That process?
I guess what I'm saying here is that NIMS will approve the process. No, I don't know what I'm saying anymore. I'm lost. If we get papers like this, it'd be a lot helpful for me to really know what they're trying to get at. I'm trying to help out here and move this process when we're getting a 10-page document, yesterday. So it'd be a lot helpful if it was spelled out a little better here. So if this motion doesn't do it, then somebody else is welcome to put a substitute motion up.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, what I heard Jim saying originally was that he wanted the agency to be able to approve the criteria for the electronic monitoring equipment, similar to what they do with the VMS equipment at this point. But I agree with you, Pat. The agency is going to be approving a sector monitoring, the operations plan anyhow. So, I mean, do we need to make it a motion? Isn't that part somewhat implicit?
I think we do need to clarify whether it's one or the other. When we did the VMS, of course, the criteria were part of the amendment. And so if we're not going to specify criteria here, then I do think we need to be specific about it being part of the operations plan. So that's what we're suggesting.
Rip?
Perhaps if we added as part of the sector operations plan at the end of that, maybe that would clarify it.
That's okay with me.
Okay with the seconder? Okay. Anyone on the council? Tom Meese?
I mean, I'm looking at the options for sector requirements, and it says the sector has to provide detailed information about a monitoring program for discards on page 69, which seemed to me a broad reading of that. The operations plan has to be approved by the RA. A broad reading of that would be that, if they walk in the room and say they've got an electronic monitoring system, they got to show how it's going to work. So I don't think this motion is inconsistent with that language.
Anyone on the council? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think this makes it better. I agree with Pat. I think this isn't like VMS to some degree because it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's going to be mandated across the sectors. VMS was a one-size-fits-all. You have to have one. Everybody may not even have electronic monitoring. There may be other forms of monitoring that are used. At any case, they're going to be kind of one-off systems, I believe, that will probably be commensurate with the fishery. There'd probably be different types of electronic monitors for different gear types. And as such, I think the sector operations plan ought to spell out the components and a rationale why they should be approved, and then it would be up to NIMS as the overall governing agency whether or not that rationale was sufficient to actually approve those electronic monitoring devices. So I think there are a number of ways you can say this, but I think this will work as written.
What's in the council? Anyone in the audience? Eric?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Eric Brazier, CCCHFA, and GB Cod Sector Manager. We support this motion. This ultimately, if the operations plans must contain descriptions of a monitoring program, and ultimately the operations plans have to be signed off on by the council and NIMS, then that is a de facto approval of an EM system. And just so the council knows, we've already started working with potential vendors to educate them and bring them up to speed on electronic monitoring systems, given that we do have two working on our fixed gear sector right now. So it is something that's on their radar screen, and they are very eager to learn how to use it and what its limitations are. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Anything further? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Rip.
Thank you. Tom, on this next one, since the next comment that we got from the service really directly impacts option two, I'm wondering if we shouldn't address the services comments first before we get to the motion.
This is on page 86, I believe, of your management measures, and it refers to provisions for transferring annual catch entitlement by sectors. There are actually two elements to this proposal. I guess you could argue there's three. But anyways, the first element allows the sectors to transfer ACE between themselves at any time during the fishing year and for a period of up to 2 weeks after the end of the fishing year. The second part of this proposal allows the sector to carry forward unused ACE, a limited amount, up to 10% of the ACE for a stock into the next fishing year and use it in the following fishing year. The service has expressed concern. This is all under option two, by the way. Option one would not allow any of these transfers. The service expressed concern that under option two, there's a possibility that there could be overfishing of some stocks, particularly if the biomass is declining and the carryover ACE and the other ACE, the total ACE, is fully harvested in the second year. And this could undermine the intent of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. There's a couple things to point out that are discussed a little bit in the analysis of impacts. This is a possibility, this being the risk of overfishing, should carry over into the next year, lead to harvest of more than the overfishing level in the second year. If you assume that your ACLs are set correctly, what that would take would be that in the second year your carryover plus whatever the sector was allocated is caught, and it amounts to more than the overfishing level. There are some mechanisms available to adjust for that. One is that when you set the ACLs, you can take into account the possibility of a carryover provision as part of your consideration of management uncertainty. And so you could conceivably, this may not be, ideal, but you could conceivably set your ACL lower to allow for this carryover into the next year and minimize your risk of overfishing. And then as you gain more experience with how much carryover is actually used, you may be able to reduce this from, say, a 10% reduction. This type of provision is commonly used. There's a reference in the document to a paper written by several people that surveyed a number of different catch share programs around the world, and many of them incorporate some sort of carryover provision in them. They feel that it is proven to be very effective in helping to avoid people rushing to catch the last amount of their fish every year, and that, with a constraint on that you're not allowed an unlimited amount of carryover, that the risk of overfishing as a result of these provisions seems to be relatively small.
We will move on to the motion at the moment, and then
Pat Kirkle.
Just a comment to that. I think you'll find that in those situations where it is used in other parts of the country or the world, that they're, that the overall TAC or quota for those fisheries is set more conservatively, so you don't have a situation where you might have overfishing. And so we're not, what we're saying is that it needs to be part of the council's decision to ensure that you don't have overfishing, to look at the potential for the carryover, the maximum potential for the carryover, and how that might affect the harvest levels in that particular year. It has to be part of the calculation.
David?
Yeah, to me, this argument is kind of largely one of, in a way, of semantics. If you catch a fish on April 1st or you catch a fish on May 31st, it's still caught in the same year. Our fishing year is an artificial man-made thing. It starts on May 1st. The year classes run January to January. So I really don't see what the issue is here, and yet from the perspective of the people who may be in the sectors, this is an absolutely huge issue. There's got to be a way to balance the books at the end of the year. And otherwise, people are going to have to stop fishing well in advance of reaching their total allowable catch, because they're not going to be able to trade in a timely manner and get everything balanced by April 30th. So in a way, this is a deal breaker. If you can't carry some of this over and balance the books in some specified period of time, then a lot of people may decide that they don't want to join a sector because they're going to leave too many fish on the table that they're unable to catch. And I understand in a way how you could say this could lead to overfishing, but since all the fish will be caught in the same calendar year, I don't think that's a valid argument. I think it's a case of, you know, in other words, again, if the fish is caught on April 30th, how's that any different in terms of overfishing than if it's caught on May 30th? They're all part of the same year. So if somebody can explain to me how that would be, then maybe I'd change my mind. But I'm still concerned about the issue of not being able to trade and balance the books at the end of the year being a deal breaker for a lot of people.
Dummies?
Yeah, I don't want to misrepresent what the service said, but I think this particular comment didn't refer to trading. It referred to being allowed to carry over. So I'm not sure that this particular comment anyway is a service objection to trading between sectors to balance the books. This particular comment is the service expressing concern over taking unused carryover and using it in the next year. Slightly different concern.
Pat Kirkle.
Yeah, Tom's right. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, I certainly understand the argument about May 30th versus, or April 30th versus May 1. But the fact of the matter is that we manage on a 12-month basis. We manage in blocks of 12 months at a time. And the decision on how much you can take in any 12-month period is based on what you took in the previous 12-month period. And so you have to bake that part of the equation when you're deciding how much to allow in the future. I mean, it just has to be part of the equation. We have to manage in blocks. And, you know, they don't necessarily make sense to the fish, but that's how the process works. And, you know, we've actually had this debate over and over again over the years in the Mid-Atlantic under their quota-based system, where there's been a lot of interest in rolling over underages. And the technical advice has always been you really can't do that unless you accommodate for the potential for that increased mortality as a result of the rollover of the underage. And so that's all we're saying.
Jamala?
Yeah, I think it's, to be practical, it's important to have a 10% carryover. I mean, if not, at the end of the year, people are going to end up running over their quota on some item because they're going to be fishing up. You know, you're up against, you got 10% left. A guy's going to say, well, I can maybe squeeze another trip out of this. And then all of a sudden, he catches 20%. And so it's I think it's going to have be more conservation minded to be able to have this carry over and allow this to happen. I mean, we see it now when people carry over 10%, 10 days, I think it is. They're always carrying them over. Some guys have always carried over 10 days forever. Then it's just the way it works. So you don't have to fish up to this artificial, I would call it artificial lines. And so I think it's an important component to keep it in there. Thank you.
Tom, before, do you think we should bring up the second part of those comments, the 45-day period now, or put out the because the well, motion is on the preferred option?
I'd actually bring this up after the motion, I think.
Okay. All right. Again, on page 86, the provisions for transferring ACE, a committee motion to recommend that for ACE transfers, option 2 be the preferred alternative.
Discussion? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? One abstention. The motion carries 15-1-1. Rip.
Tom.
On the next page of the letter from the service, there's a comment that the transfer provisions allow people to execute a transfer up to 2 weeks into the next fishing year to balance the books at the end of the year. And in order to facilitate NIMPS reviewing how much each sector caught and what, if any, overages need to be adjusted for, what we had also written into this measure is that at the beginning of the year, the service will withhold 20% of a sector's ACE from every sector in order to allow time for these transfers to take place for the first 2 weeks and then NIMPS to figure out if there are any overage adjustments that need to be made and then release the rest of it. And so we built in a 45-day period when this 20% would be withheld so that these sorts of administrative things could be stepped through. And the service has suggested that 45 days may be insufficient to process these transfers, and Amendment 16 should allow additional time for this task. They did not suggest what they thought was an appropriate number of days for that. It's also unclear to me whether this should be interpreted as meaning that any transfers in the course of a fishing year are going to take longer than 45 days to process so that a sector won't know when the transfer has actually been approved yet.
First off, it's not the transfers that take 45 days, so the two are somewhat unrelated. How long they'll take in the year, during the year, is unrelated to this particular provision, which has to do with determining at the end of the year whether or not there are any overages. I think, frankly, given that they can do this 2 weeks into the fishing year, I think we could live with 60 days, but even that makes me nervous.
Does anybody want to make a motion to change the language to 60 days? Mike Leary?
I'd like to move to change the language to 61 days.
61 days?
Yes.
Is there a second? Seconded by Sally McGee. Discussion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. All right, we're going to take a quick break here, 10-minute break. Okay, Rep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next item, page 94, it's table 11. This is for informational purposes by committee consensus. Staff modified the table on page 94 to include Atlantic wolffish under all gear, under gillnet redfish, witch flounder, American plaice, and under long lines redfish. I don't. Do we need an action on that, Tom? No.
Tom?
No, we don't need an action on that one. But there were a couple points raised by the service on other sector issues, and I think once we get to page 94, we're out of the sector section. So I don't know if this is actually working to try and keep track of all the services' comments as we go along or not, but they did have a couple others in here on the sector policy stuff. I don't know if you want to bring those up now or.
I think I'd rather go through the motions from the committee and then come back and address the services letter. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Next is page 95. It's a committee motion. The committee recommends that the council remove from the recreational commercial allocation table the stocks that will not meet the criteria established to have an allocation at this time.
Committee motion. Discussion on the committee motion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question. All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries 14-0-0. Rep.
Okay, still on page 95, a committee motion. The committee recommends option 2 as a preferred alternative for the commercial recreational allocation, but does not recommend picking a preferred set of dates.
Committee motion, discussion. Frank Blount.
I support the motion, but as I said in committee, I also think we should be picking a preferred here. I'm not going to die on my sword because it's probably not going to go anywhere.
Anyone else in the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council, last chance. Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Unanimous.
On to page 96, under Days at Sea Transfer Program, motion. Committee motion for days at sea leasing and transfer measures. The committee recommends as preferred option, option 2, which is eliminate the days at sea transfer conservation tax. Option 2, sub-option A, which is the no refund of days at sea taxed for transfers completed prior to Amendment 16, and option 5.
Committee motion, discussion. Tom Neese.
In case somebody's having trouble finding option 5, it's the second option 3. There's a typo in the text, and we corrected that at the committee, but I don't know if everybody here noticed it.
Anyone on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Tom, or Rip, I'm just having a little trouble following this. So the preferred from the committee was option two to eliminate the transfer tax and also no refund for transfers that have happened previously. Those are both preferred alternatives?
Yes.
Okay. Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Thirteen. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. The motion carries 13-0. One abstention. Rip.
The next motion is page 102 under special management programs. It's a committee motion to allow the use of 6-inch diamond or square mesh cod end in the eastern U.S. Canada area haddock sap.
Discussion on the committee motion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. 12. Opposed? Abstentions? 2 abstentions. Motion carries 12-0 with 2 abstentions.
Under the same section, page 102, a committee motion to adjust the southern boundary of the triangle in the eastern U.S.-Canada area haddock sap to the south to the northern border of the habitat of particular concern in closed area 2.
Committee motion, discussion from the council. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. 15. Unanimous. Sorry, 15 with one abstention.
The next is on page 103 under the program revisions due to updated stock status, committee motion to entertain modifications to the Category B regular days at sea program on George's Bank in Amendment 16 to change gear trawl mesh size in Category B regular days at sea program to 6-inch diamond or square.
Tom Neese.
I just want to point out something I noticed when putting together the decision document is that the committee motion was specific to this 6-inch requirement for George's Bank and the Category B program. If you read the language that's in the draft amendment, I missed that and I didn't write in for George's Bank. So the language in the document should say Category B day at sea program on George's Bank. You're allowed to use a 6-inch mesh. I believe the rationale for that at the committee was that we're trying to target George's Bank haddock primarily, and that's where that 6-inch would be helpful.
Discussion from the council. David Gaethel.
Yeah, we did have an extensive discussion about that at the committee level, and we did decide to apply it to George's Bank only. We you know, we talked about the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank, and we ended up back at Georges Bank only.
Anyone else on the council? Rodney?
Yeah, I have a question. That's 6-inch either or 6-inch just diamond? Is it the choice?
Diamond or square?
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Fourteen in favor. Opposed? Abstentions? Three abstentions. Motion carries 14-0. Three abstentions.
Page 105. Under commercial fisheries measures, committee motion for all non-sector vessel mortality control options for eastern U.S. Canada area prior to the beginning of the fishing year, the regional administrator will specify the appropriate cod trip limit.
Discussion on the committee motion. Anyone on the council? Go to the audience. Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. Motion carries 16-0. One abstention.
Page 107, under non-sector vessels, option 2A, committee motion for day gillnet vessels that straddle two differential counting areas on the same trip, the most restrictive counting measure applies to the entire trip.
Discussion on the committee motion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Ready for the question. All those in favor, raise your hand. 17-0-0.
Okay, moving on to page 109, non-sector vessels, option 3A. Committee motion to recommend the council designate 4.4.2.3, which is non-sector vessels, option 3A, 24-hour clock, restricted gear areas, as the preferred alternative.
Discussion on the committee motion. David Gatham.
Yeah, I obviously can't support this motion. I'll never support a 24-hour clock. So I would make a motion to substitute that the council does not go to public hearing with a preferred alternative.
Is there a second? Seconded by Doug Grout. Discussion on the motion to substitute. Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with New Hampshire's small boat fishery. This will be, this could be dangerous. And I think it will also be using, it will put them at a tremendous disadvantage, so I can't support it. So I support this motion to amend.
Rodney.
Can somebody explain to me why a 24-hour clock is any different than a 12-hour clock when it becomes dangerous?
David?
You know, most people could stay awake for 12 hours that operate a boat by themselves. 24 hours is really pushing it. I mean, this is the, it, you know, it may be an argument of semantics whether 24 hours is You know, whether differential counting to 2-1, I mean, the times may come out the same, but in fact, the psychological rationale that goes into somebody's head is very much different. If I'm going to be penalized for 12 hours, yes, I'll probably try and stay for 12. That's bad enough. I don't like any clocks. You know, I don't like any minimums, because the minute you put a minimum out there, it's a target for people to shoot for. As to the biological ramifications of it, again, the equity issues, again, somebody that already fishes 24 hours, this doesn't change things for them one bit. For people who fish less than 24 hours, it's some kind of a tax on their fishery. It's some kind of differential counting rate. Again, whether it's 12 or 24, I'm just really opposed to 24 based on the fact that, you know, I don't think it's safe for a guy to operate a boat for 24 hours. The boats that operate around the clock have, you know, an alternate captain of some kind, whether they call him a mate or whatever. I mean, I think the Coast Guard and the recreational fisheries specifically demands that you can operate a boat for more than 12 hours. So I think that's why 12 hours is in there. I think that's the maximum that one person can legally operate a vessel when they carry passengers for hire.
Pat Kirkle.
Well, we've raised similar concerns with the 24-hour clock and the need for the council to overcome the objections that have been raised as a result of safety issues. Of course, we don't have a 12-hour clock, so I'm not sure there would be much difference between a 12-hour and a 24-hour clock beyond the ones that David's pointed out. This alternative, if I read it correctly, has a reduction in days at sea of 50%. And then there's the 24-hour clock counting on top of that. Is that correct? Is that what the preferred alternative is, the days at sea reduction of 50% with the 24-hour clock on top of it? Okay. I'm going to support the okay motion to substitute because I object to the this alternative being the preferred alternative.
Jim Marlin.
Yeah, a 24-hour clock doesn't mean a guy has to stay out 24 hours. It just means that he's going to be charged 24 hours if he comes in with a full day's trip limit, with his trip limit. So, well, he'll be charged 24 hours for fishing. It doesn't mean he can stay out. People right now, my understanding is a lot of people in the small boat fleet are staying 24 hours in 1 minute. That's the way they're operating so that they can have the extra days trip limit. I mean, I don't know the numbers, but I think it's quite significant of the number of people doing that. So I can't see this as any more of a safety issue than the 2-for-1 area we have right now. You're incentivizing people with smaller boats to go further offshore to get into a 1-to-1 area. So I just don't see this as any more of a safety issue than any of the other regulations that we currently manage under or are even contemplating managing under. Thank you.
Rodney.
Yeah, that's basically what I have. It's not a safety issue. It's an issue of how much you get rewarded for. And I don't like to see a safety issue be put on it. A safety issue is when you demand somebody to stay out 24 hours. You're not demanding them to stay out 24 hours. You're just charging them for 24 hours. If you go down to George's Bank, you get charged for 24 hours before you even put your net in the water. And you get charged for 24 hours coming home. That's part of the deal. That doesn't make it any safer that I have to travel out there before I start fishing, because I made that decision when I left the dock that I was going to George's Bank and I was going to forfeit 24 hours for my traveling out and another 24 hours for the travel in. That doesn't make me any less safer than if I didn't get charged for those 2 days. That's the point I was trying to make. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gatham.
With all due respect, I hardly ever disagree with Rodney on anything, but this is, in this particular case, there is a psychological effect at work here. If I go out and I'm charged for 8 hours and they differentially count that, I'm going to be charged for 16. If they tell me before I leave the dock that I'm going to be charged for 24, I'm going to stay the best part of that 24 that I can stay. You can't help it. It's psychological. I see it at work in my area all the time. You know, that's, they're right. There are some people that have chose to stay out 24 hours in a minute. God bless them. I'm not one of them. And I know a lot of people that aren't. I'll throw fish over. I'd rather throw fish over and take one day's worth of fish and go home and be safe than stay out there for 24 hours, especially in the winter when we get these little weather windows that sometimes are only 3 or 4 hours long. Now, if you're going to charge somebody 24 hours for a 3 or 4 hour weather window, I bet most of them are going to try and use a good portion of that 24 hours before they go home. And so in this case, I really do disagree on this particular issue. I may be the only person here that does, but I want it on the record loud and clear that I do think it's a safety issue, and I'll keep voicing it.
Anyone else in the council on the motion to substitute? Go to the audience. David?
Yeah, thank you, Dave Marciano, Dable Gilnetter out of Gloucester, 34-foot boat. I do support the 24-hour clock. Unfortunately, I'm not too fond the way it was created here, but I'm hoping someday we can change that. But B-days is 24-hour days. Safety issue didn't come up there at all. And then you can generally look to the Gillnet fleet if you want to see the results of having minimum counting. As a Gillnetter, we're subject to 15-hour days, have been for a long time. And I believe in haste, when we first put the 15-hour clock in, I even made comments similar to some of the comments that were made that we're going to stay out. But the reality is when you get your limit, you go home. There isn't a hell of a lot you can do about it. Just stay out, to just bang your head against the wall, doesn't really become practical when you finally live with a minimum clock. You know, it's essentially cutting your nose off to spite your face. When you get your limit, you go home. I think under the right scenario, a 24-hour clock could allow you to eliminate discarding, increase efficiency, and end overfishing by having a hard tack without a derby fishery. But it'd have to be constructed different than what it is now. But I do fundamentally support the 24-hour clock. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Aaron?
Thank you. Aaron Doherty, Penobscot East Resource Center. I'd have to say that we're also opposed to the 24-hour clock. I think if you've got 24 hours and you've got that option, you're not necessarily going to catch your limit, and I think that there is a good chance, there's that incentive there to stay out 24 hours. I do see the perspective that this could be a safety issue too, and for that reason I have to say that we're opposed to it. Thanks.
Anyone else in the audience? Okay, back to the council. The motion to substitute. Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Ten. Opposed. Let's start over. All those in favor of the motion to substitute, raise your hand and keep it up, please. Nine. Opposed. Eight. Motion to substitute carries 9-8. Okay, so that's now the main motion is substituted, which says we're not going to go to the public with a preferred alternative on how to meet mortality objectives. Right? Unless I'm reading that wrong. Tom, could you just briefly touch on the alternatives we have? types of alternatives we have to meet mortality objectives? We just talked about that one. What are the other ones?
Well, technical difficulties here. We've got three main options. This option is the region. All of these options include days at sea reductions. There are some. The first option at present is referred to option 2A. That will become option 1, but we were trying to reference a PDT report so people could track them through. Revise on an 18% days at sea reduction, which I think is the default, and differential days at sea and trip limits in order to meet the mortality objectives. The differential days at sea areas extend much further than they do now. They basically cover almost the entire Gulf of Maine, probably about two-thirds of Georgia's banks, and a good part of southern New England. The option you just talked about includes a 50% days at sea reduction from the framework 42 allocations, 24-hour clock, modifies a number of the trip limits as well. And it includes some restricted gear areas on western Georgia's Bank and southern New England. And then we've got the third option. It's option 4, which relies on a days at sea reduction of 40% from the framework 42 allocations. Once again, it modifies trip limits, and it also has restricted gear areas, larger restricted gear area, particularly in southern New England. That's kind of it in a nutshell without going into a lot of specifics on each option.
Okay. So we're back on the main motion as substituted. Vote in the positive is to not identify a preferred alternative. Comments from the council? Anyone in the audience? Okay, ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Nine. Opposed? Seven. Abstentions? One. Okay, motion carries 9-7 with one abstention. Rip.
The next item is on page 112, Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Small Mesh Fisheries Gear Requirement. It's a committee motion for the Southern New England drop chain requirement. The committee recommends the council adopt the Groundfish Committee recommendations. They were attached with the document number 14, I think, at least they were with mine. They're page 12, 13, and 14 of that document, which outlines the coordinates of the area and the specifications of the drop chain requirements.
Committee motion, discussion from the council. Anyone in the audience? I see a hand.
Okay. Hi, my name is Bonnie Brady. I'm the executive director of the Long Island Commercial Fishing Association. I just had a couple of questions regarding this gear requirement that was came out of Brownfish Committee. The science that was done on this gear specifically, where was that? Did that take place? Anyone know?
If you're asking, is there peer-reviewed science on it?
Is there any science where that science took place? What region? What area?
Well, the industry work that's been done on it was essentially in the same area where the.
But it wasn't done. I believe it was done actually in Cape Cod, wasn't it? Not in southern New England, the area of.
Yeah, what Bonnie's referring to, I mean, I think it's a legitimate question. The question is, what scientific experiments support this gear as written here? And the short answer is, we don't have any. We do have experiments that experimented with a similar gear that was incorporated into the Whiting Rays foot rope trawl. Most of those experiments, if not all of them, took place up north in Cape Cod Bay. The gear is constructed a little bit differently. I'm not a gear expert, but, for example, the Whiting Rays foot rope trawl, I believe, doesn't allow anything on the foot rope, no cookies or anything like that, whereas this gear allows that. So there were no specific experiments that tested this particular configuration of this gear that I am aware of.
Also, because, as you all might notice when looking around, there is no New York member to the New England Fishery Management Council, but we are regulated by you all. In addition to whichever decisions you make regarding a closure or closed area, the brown section, basically, Long Island becomes Brown Island in a result of the closure. Part of the problem is we do actually have a couple of other fisheries that might still be able to exist, squid fishery, whiting fishery, and there's been quite a list of complaints from our members regarding the drop chain in those fisheries. It does talk about in the to January 29th meeting summary that the net's very effective at avoiding flatfish, but according to our members, it's good at avoiding squid and good at avoiding whiting and good at avoiding everything else. And without any kind of data to support it in this area, especially when there are some small mesh exemptions that would be allowed, we would really appreciate you guys take a better look at this before you decide our fate for us. Thank you.
Tom?
Yeah, I don't know if this addresses Bonnie's concern in its entirety or not, but the committee at its meeting did talk about not requiring this on nets that have large meshes at the opening, which I believe was meant to try and address squid nets, but I could be wrong, and I don't know if it does address all squid nets or not. So that nets with that large mesh would not be required to use the drop chain.
Go back to the audience. I see a hand. Joel?
Joel Hovnesian, North Point Judith, Rhode Island. I have to agree with a lot of what Bonnie's saying. There's certainly times of the year when the characteristics and the way the fish are acting are not conducive to towing this configuration around and catching anything. I think at times of the year in certain places there's it merits the use, but as far as down our way right at the moment, I think you'd if you were to poll the majority of the fishermen, they'd tell you that it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt a lot. I know at times the squid get down fairly hard on bottom in the warm water summertime fisheries, and going to have a hard time catching fish with this net. Whiting, possibly you'll catch them. As far as the large mesh openings, that net is primarily used offshore in the winter fishery. We've had very, very little success pulling that net around inshore in the summertime, catching squid. It's been tried. I've done it myself. And the results weren't very encouraging. So at a minimum, I would suggest that we do some more research on this before we move forward and try to make this a regulation. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Come back to the council. Pat Kirkle. Jim Odlin.
Yeah, this measure came to us from people in Rhode Island, and I think they were responding to the option that if they don't do something, they could potentially be shut down from the fisheries that they're trying to prosecute. And, you know, there was a number of people in the room that have expertise in gear. I realize there hasn't been an experiment on this gear before, but we have implemented gear changes without experiments. This is not like we're doing an SAP here. And so I'm just putting out these for rationale of why the committee took the time and developed, worked with the industry and developed this. And I think it's a good option and should stay in the stay in the amendment.
Rodney?
Yeah, Joel made some of the points I was going to make. The large mesh net does not work inside. The other thing you have to remember is when these guys are prosecuting their squid, butterfish, scup, there is no interaction with the yellowtail or the flounder at that time of the year. That's what everybody's forgetting. That yellowtail and flounder are not there 12 months out of the year where these guys are fishing. So, and if they're going to use the 12-month drop chain, they're not going to be successful at catching squid. I think that was an alternative. People got scared, and they said, well, we'll go to 12-inch drop chain. I don't think it was flushed out because nobody uses that with that. Them boats that fish inside for squid. When the squid comes up inside to the beaches, Nantucket Sound, it's hot on the bottom. But that's in the summertime, and there's no flounder or yellowtail up in there at that time. Flounder and yellowtail are offshore.
Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, I was convinced to support this largely because of the fishermen who came forward with a very sincere attempt to develop some strategies, some approaches to deal with our concerns about winter flounder, especially the catch of winter flounder during small mesh fishing. We commended them for their approach, for the hard work they put into this. And while I can understand concern about squid, I know that in my own state's waters, you know, we're prompting, you know, the use of our raised foot rope trawl to get the net off the bottom because they're on the bottom, hot on the bottom, spawning. And certainly squid should be taken as part of any mobile gear fishery, but at the same time, if we can reduce some of the fishing pressure on them while they are spawning, it's a good thing. Plus, the egg mops are on the bottom, too. So, again, with the emphasis being on keeping the pressure off the winter flounder, you know, recognizing Rodney's specific concerns that are very valid, it seems like a reasonable approach for us to take.
Rodney.
Yeah, the main difference, David, is the 12-inch drop chain. When you fish with that other net, you don't use a 12-inch drop chain. That's the main difference. You're lifting that gear a foot off the bottom. That's the main difference.
Pat Kirkham.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about this for some of the same reasons that other people have, that, you know, this was a proposal from the industry and you know, an attempt to be proactive in addressing the Southern New England winter flounder problem. But it does suffer from a lack of analysis. We haven't approved gears without analysis in the past, with one exception that I can think of, and it was a specific situation where we did not count on that gear in any way to provide any mortality reductions. And it was limited exclusively to the groundfish fishery in certain areas. This is being proposed with a much broader application than that, and so I think we need some appreciation for how the gear does interact with those other fisheries, and importantly, we need to be careful not to count on this in any way as a mortality reduction for groundfish. So if the council were to move forward with this, you'd need to look at it as something that provided some unquantifiable, potentially provided some unquantifiable benefits, but did not aid in in achieving the necessary mortality reductions.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah. I think it's important to keep in mind here, this whole discussion started at the groundfish committee level when there was a serious discussion about either requiring the raised foot rope trawl in all small mesh fisheries or shutting down small mesh fisheries that had a discard of winter flounder. And industry members that were there came forward and said there's a better way, that this net caught some squid. They said it didn't catch as many. They were right up front about it. But they said catching some was better than catching none, and those were the alternatives that were being bandied about at the time. So I think, you know, given the dire situation we're in southern New England, do you want to fish for something or do you want to fish for nothing? And you know, there's a gear diagram here to answer Bonnie's questions provided by Trawlworks. This is a net that apparently a lot of people in Rhode Island fish with and fish with successfully. You know, having been in this position in northern New England where I had stuff crammed down my throat that I didn't like either, but the choice was either use it or lose it. I think we've got to keep this in as an option because the other option is you lose it, and there is no fishery. And I think under those conditions, the same people that are saying, geez, we don't want to use this net, and come back and say, geez, that net looks pretty good. So anyway, I support the committee's motion.
Anyone else from the council? Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, I just want to agree with what Jim Odlin and what Dave Gaethel said. This was brought forward from industry members. They took the time to get the drawings made at Trawlworks and a set of potential specifications. And it is in response to, as David said, a dire threat. And until that threat is resolved, I think we should keep it in the document. We can make a further decision on it later on, but for now I think it should stay in the document. Thank you.
Any further from the council? Doug Grout.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with leaving it in right now, but as Pat said, without some kind of gear work, we're not going to know what kind of credit or benefit you're going to get out of it like some of the other gear types. So I would hope if there is any option for some kind of gear work here that we can come up with some kind of quantifiable savings here that you're going to have so that it just doesn't go in as just a gear type where you won't get any benefit from it.
Anything further from the council? Rodney.
Yeah, earlier on we were worried about redirection. We're worried about sending boats to George's Banks. Right now we're going to send boats up to David, and I hope he's receptive to this because they're all going to be up there because they got nothing to fish with. The amount of squid they're going to catch with this is not enough to make a trip on. Bottom line.
Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Ten opposed. Four abstentions. Three abstentions. The motion carries 10-4 with three abstentions. Rip.
Page 112, the Gulf of Maine Haddock Sink Gillnet Pilot Program. Committee motion to incorporate the Gillnet Pilot Program for the use of 6-inch gillnets to target haddock in the Gulf of Maine.
Discussion on the committee motion. Pat Kirkle.
There doesn't seem to be any way proposed in the document for actually monitoring this pilot program. I'm not exactly sure what a pilot program is, since it doesn't seem to have a beginning and an end in particular. So how are we going to know whether or not this pilot is working or not working, and whether we ever change it from a pilot to a full-fledged program or whatever we call it. And I don't I mean, it seems to me this is a SAP without going through all the processes that we've required everybody to go through to actually have a SAP.
Tom Neese.
Well, first, in some respects, this doesn't qualify as a SAP because it doesn't authorize the use of Category B days at sea. Not that every SAP has to do that, because you could conceivably out of a SAP that gives access to a closed area. But this one doesn't give access to a closed area, so you've got to use A days. Second, with respect to duration of the program and why we're calling it a pilot program, on page 113, it's got that the program will be in place fishing year 2010 through 2012. So I guess it's basically three fishing years to run the program. With respect to observer coverage, we did build in requirements here similar to some of the other requirements in other programs, both for notifying NIMS in advance whether vessels decided to participate in the program, and also we threw in the 72-hour advance notice to allow observers time to be able to meet the vessels and participate in the program. We did not, however, specify a specific level of observer coverage for this particular program. Of course, I don't think we've done that for some of our other similar type programs either.
I guess I have a question for, the chair of the committee. Is there a reason that this is just the Gulf of Maine and not Georges Bank?
Maggie wants to answer that. I just don't recall. Tom probably has the answer.
No, there was at the committee meeting, and I think you're going to have to call on Maggie, because I remember this came up at the committee meeting. Why don't we have this everywhere, including Georges Bank? And there was a reason, but I can't recall what that reason was.
Maggie?
The reason is because of the relative status of Georges Bank Cod compared to Gulf of Maine Cod. Gulf of Maine Cod is nearly rebuilt, and Georges Bank Cod is in a very different situation. So it was felt that this limited number of gillnets on A days at sea with whatever the possession limit is for Cod would be acceptable.
You're on the council. Anyone in the audience? David?
Yes, thank you. I urge you to support this. We've been working on this for a long time, since when we locked access to Haddock. It had nothing to do with the council. It was a federal judge in a lawsuit from the environmental industry stripped away 100% access to Haddock for the gillnet fleet in the inshore Gulf of Maine. Now, at the time, it was a nearly rebuilt resource. Now it's fully rebuilt. You know, that just wasn't right on face value. But again, it wasn't even a council decision to push that mesh size up that big. It was Judge Kessler's ruling that did that. We need this. It's the equivalent of throwing us a bone. Even with a 6-inch gillnet, the gillnets are the most selective gear type you manage. Even at 6-inch, when you consider other species, we'll be with pollock, will be approximately 4 or 5 inches above the minimum size with our interactions with pollock. With Gulf of Maine cod, the minimum size that we'll access with these nets, if they are around, will be 2 or 3 inches above the minimum size for Gulf of Maine cod. So, you know, there's still plenty of selectivity built in there. All this is doing is trying to get a little bit of access to a fully rebuilt resource. And as far as the fear-mongering that goes on, that, you know, we're going to use this mesh to target small pollock or scrod cod that are worth pennies a pound, as opposed to targeting haddock that can be worth a couple bucks a pound, even in today's economy. I mean, that just doesn't hold water. You know, maybe a government agency might use the gear like that, but not a fisherman. You know what I mean? If you're trying to make do with the handful of days you got, you want to use the gear profitably and effectively, and we really need this. We haven't had access to haddock since then, and there is the idea that you could go with the hawks, but unfortunately, in the Gulf of Maine, we have such severe restrictions on the hooks and numbers of hooks. You can't access any appreciable amount of haddock unless you show total disregard for the laws that are in place. And then there's the fact that at least with a net, we can do it without juvenile discards of other species like cod and pollock, which you can't say with the hooks. Hooks, we fumble around with the hooks now, but we don't have nearly enough hooks to make a difference, and we catch a whole lot of juveniles while we're doing it with the hooks. Thank you.
Vito?
Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Just quickly, we would support this this measure for the gillnet, as the gillnet fleet, I think, has been lost a lot of its diversity and flexibility at fishing for different stocks through the year. And most of that's been, you know, the changes in the clock and, most importantly, the changes in the mesh size. So to promote a more diversified fleet, they've got the same amount of A-days, so they're going to be splitting up their effort onto haddock. I think that would be a good thing.
Anyone else? Maggie?
Thank you. I did want to, I know that the regional administrator raised the concern about pollock in her letter, and I would just answer that by saying that whatever the possession limit ends up being for pollock would apply to this program as well. And again, it's using A days at sea. So it's not, you know, whatever limited number of days that they end up with in the common pool. I would also point out that this proposal was fully endorsed by the Groundfish Advisory Panel.
Aaron.
Aaron Doherty, Penobscot East Resource Center. I know that this came up in committee, and I'm sure this was probably discussed there. I'm sorry I wasn't at the committee meeting. But I'm just wondering, I know that I see that there's a limit on the number of nets for day boat fishermen. Why not for trip fishermen? And is that something that should be considered as well? Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further? Ready for the question. All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Opposed? Abstentions? Two abstentions. Motion carries 15-0. Two abstentions.
We're on to page 113, recreational management measures. Committee motion to remove the second sentence from option one of section 4.4.3.1, provisions for landing fillets by recreational fishermen.
Discussion from the council. Anyone in the audience? Jim Kendall.
Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting. The reason I'm up here now is to try and get a better understanding of what this means. Will there be provisions for a landing of fillets? And if so, what is the number being proposed?
This does not change the number of fillets, et cetera, that you can land. The second sentence that this would remove is, the minimum sizes apply to whole fish or to any part of the fish found in possession. Therefore, fillets except that party and charter vessels possessing valid state permits authorizing filleting at sea may possess fillets smaller than the sizes if all the state requirements are met.
So basic, excuse me, but basically it's tied to the state requirements of minimum size and total number of fillets, is that correct? I apologize because I wasn't at the committee. I'm just trying to brief myself. If that is the case, I would say that whatever the decision on it is, and the reason I'm bringing it up is a lot of people were not here when we went through the process for allowing fillets for commercial fishermen to bring home. There should be some sort of equity involved as well. If a commercial fisherman is restricted to two or four fillets, then I would think that something appropriate would be considered for application to the recreational fishermen. There shouldn't be so much disparity, if there is, and I'm not saying that I know that there is, but I would like that the council, if they don't know, to make sure that they are apprised of it. There was an issue just raised about gill nets, why one gill net sector has to have a fixed number of nets and the other doesn't, and I know, or most likely know, that there's some people here that didn't understand what that was relevant to. So my question is here, is this fair and equitable as was imposed upon the commercial fishing industry?
It does not alter the existing number of fish that may be landed. The next sentence translates into the number of fillets that you're required to have two for a, you know, to translate into a whole fish. So it's the same number of fish that they're allowed to land currently. It's not changing any of that.
All right. Well, it doesn't state that there. It just says removing the second sentence. So that's why
it does. If you read the entire paragraph that.
Well, like I said, I know nothing about the original motion or the action that took place. I just wanted to see if I could get that information. Thank you.
Harriet?
I guess I got the same kind of a question. Are you saying that, I believe it's Mr. Cunningham, that in the second sentence they're gonna bring in one fish for two or – two fish for one, or what are you saying?
The second sentence has nothing to do with that. The third sentence, which remains in that, specifies, I'm just trying to get it here, for enforcing bag limit restrictions, the number of fillets will be converted to whole fish at the place of landing by dividing the fillet number by two. If fish are filleted into single butterfly fillets, each fillet is deemed to be from one whole fish.
Okay, so for us in the commercial fishery, if we brought in any fillets, our fillet would have to match the whole size of the fish, or it would be illegal. Is this the same? Are you using the same standard here, just saying it another way? I haven't read it and digested it, so I'm asking you. I don't feel there should be any difference. Why should there be any difference in rules for commercial fishermen and recreational fishermen?
That might take us a long time to go through all of it. There are already size differences between commercial and recreational.
Yeah, but I'm saying the main principle, that if you bring it in whole, if we have a fillet, and whatever size that fish has to be whole, that fillet has to meet that, or you have to have the racks with you. Either way, in commercial. So I'm just saying, speaking for commercial people, I think we're as trustworthy as anyone else. Let's put it that way. So I would like to see the same standards in principle. Thank you.
Else? Back to the council. David?
I think it would be helpful to read the whole statement minus the sentence that proposes to be removed so that the audience will understand what it is exactly we're talking about because they don't have the document. And basically what it would say is recreational, including party and charter fishermen, will be allowed to land fillets with the skin off. We delete the next sentence, and then it'll go on to say, for enforcing bag limit restrictions, the number of fillets will be converted to whole fish at the place of landing by dividing the fillet number by two. If the fish are filleted into a single butterfly fillet, each fillet will be deemed to be one whole fish. First of all, this is only one option out of several. It may not be the one adopted. What it's doing, in answer to Harriet's question, yes, it's setting up a differential, that because you've removed the statement saying that the minimum size of the fillet will be equal to the minimum fish size, you can now fillet fish that are smaller than the fillet size. So in theory, you could have people who are very good filleters filleting fish that are undersized and making them appear to be perhaps legal-sized fish. That is definitely a flaw in this as it's written now. You know, if you require the fillet size to be equal to the minimum fish size, then you obviously couldn't have got it off a fish that's smaller than the legal-sized fish. To a second question, is there a difference between this and the commercial? Yes, there is. The commercial says you will land fish with the skin on, and so it's identifiable, and in the fillet sizes will equal the minimum fish size. I don't have a problem with having a difference between commercial and recreational. When we get to picking the final option, this may or may not be the option we pick. I want to warn everybody about that in advance. I'm not saying I endorse this. This is just a change in the language in one option so that it can go to public hearing. So I think we should all keep that in mind before we get really excised about the fact that this is going to be the final language for filleted fish in Amendment 16.
Tommy's.
Yeah, the big change here is this allows recreational fillets to be landed with the skin off. They're already allowed to be landed with fillets that are smaller than the minimum size as long as they come from legal-sized fish. The way they're counted is already the way they're counted now. The big difference here is they're allowed to be landed with the skin off.
Doug Grout.
Is there a reason this motion applied to only option one as opposed to options one and two? Because don't they have the exact same second sentence in it?
David?
Well, that was the point, is that you have two options now that are very different, and it gives people a choice. That in the second one, you do still have that sentence in there. And you also have a size, what is it, two square inches of skin or something? I don't remember exactly what it was. We had a huge debate about how big the skin had to be. I mean, these are the kind of things that really slow things down. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, we could certainly argue about how important they are, but this is what we determined. And so you have two options here. They're very different, and, you know, the council will pick one when we pick a final, when we have the final vote on Amendment 16.
Frank Baum.
Yeah, I think the reason it's in option two, because I missed it, I voted for option two when it came forward. Right now, I didn't think we were trying to change the existing regulation, which says you may possess fillet smaller than the minimum size. What we tried to add into this was an option of skinning fish. We weren't trying to put an option in of changing the minimum size of the fillets. And if that got in on option two, it was something that was missed. I missed it at the committee meeting, and I definitely missed it at the council meeting, because what I supported at the council meeting, I think Doug was surprised that I supported it. I told him I would support it. And now that I see it in there, that's not what I thought I was supporting. I'd like a clarification if that is what was in the original motion on option two.
Tom Neese.
Okay, this is the same issue I had with option one and why I brought it to the committee and asked for clarification. Because option one originally started with a committee and council motion that said you can land fish with skin on. That's all it said. So now we got to convert that into a management measure. So I went to the fluke regs and I copied the fluke regs and I asked the committee, what do you want? First time I asked, I didn't get any answers, so it stayed in there. Then at the November council meeting, a motion was passed quite similar to this, that said recreational fishermen be allowed to land fillets and that ground fish species with a recreational allocation of an allowable catchment limit must have fillets landed with at least 2 square inches of skin on to allow positive identification. So the language in both options was pretty much written identical based on the fluke regs to say allowed with skin on or allowed with skin off or allowed with skin on with 2 inches. If the council wants to change it, change it. But your motion was not specific as to how you wanted these things worded. And that's my passion for the day.
Feisty. All right. What do you want to do with this? Ready for the question? Tom Neese.
Well, I mean, my suggestion here is if you don't want it in either of them, you know, put it in one motion. Just amend this motion to say, you know, take that second out. I think it's the second sentence in the first one and the third sentence in the second one. So, you know, just take it out of both of them at once if you want to.
Frank Blount.
I make the motion that we amend so that option one and option two, that sentence is removed from both.
There a second. Seconded by Dave Preble. Discussion on the motion to amend. Dave Gaethel.
I have to ask the question now. I knew what I was voting for, and they're two very different options, and I think one is supported by enforcement and one isn't, because you can't enforce the minimum fish size if the fillet size is smaller than the legal size. And so there was a very clear discussion here about which one it was going to be. And you know, I don't know if there's anybody here from enforcement to refresh our memory, but there was, you know, the minute you go to a minimum fillet size that's smaller than the minimum fish size, you can't enforce the minimum fish size unless, as Harriet said, you've got the racks to prove what they came from. And that was the whole idea of filleting fish at sea in the first place, not to bring the racks in. So we basically gave the industry a choice, which was fillet fish that have legal size fillets and leave a chunk of skin on so we can be sure that a cod's a cod, a pollock's a pollock, and a haddock's a haddock, whatever it is, or that the council would knowingly produce a regulation that would not allow for enforcement of the minimum fish size. So the two options are very different. If you remove this sentence from both of them, then that's very different from what's in here right now.
Doug.
So everybody's looking for clarifications. My clarification, my intent, David and Frank, was to have an alternative so that you could be identifying the fillet. And my intent was to have both options similar except for that. Now, originally, we had something in there that stated that the minimum fillet size was going to be the size of the fish. My most important concern here was being able to identify and dealing with bag limits, because as you know, in our state, we do have minimum fillet size, and we're going to apply it to landings. So my intent is to have something, an option that's similar but actually enforceable here, because you've got something to identify the fish with, particularly with bag limits.
Anyone else?
If I might ask, Doug, you're saying that as it currently is, I mean, because one of these is skin, piece of skin on, one is a piece, no skin on.
That they would be similar. So originally I was going to vote against this option.
Okay, make sure that the range of options or the option you want is contained within the range we have, and let's move on. Frank?
All I know is I asked for clarification of the way this is going. It's going to be worse than what it was when we started. Right now it says you have to land fillets with the skin on that can be smaller. The option was that you could land the fillets with the skin off. That's what was asked for by the industry. And now what we're saying is you have to leave the skin on 2 square inches, plus they're going to have to be the minimum size if this doesn't pass. So you've just piled a restriction on top of a restriction. And originally, the skin was supposed to be left on to determine the number of fish that were caught, to determine bag limits. And at the time, there were no bag limits when this went in place. So it made no sense in the original time that it went in place. It had nothing to do with minimum size.
Council, on the motion to amend, ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. 4. Opposed. 9. Opposed? Abstentions? 4. Motion fails 4-9-4. Back on the main motion. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? 3 opposed. Abstentions? So that was 11-3-3. Motion carries. Rip?
The next item is on page 115. Prohibition on retention of Atlantic wolffish. Committee motion. That the committee forward to the council the recommendation that we include a year-round prohibition on possession of Atlantic wolffish, option 1, as the only option other than no action.
Discussion on the committee motion. Anyone in the audience? Mr. Libby?
Gary Libby, Mid-Coast Fishermen's Association, Port Clyde. Earlier we had a discussion, which I thought went, there wasn't really enough data to support much on wolffish at all. So the part of this that I would go for would be no action where the data's not there to really support it the way I understood it.
Joel?
Ditto.
Jim?
Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting. I'd like to comment on the process that's been involved in coming up with this particular motion and the reason for it. Actually, I don't think the reason has been shown. It's been a lack of information on this particular species, and it's been a advertising campaign for several of the environmental organizations. And if they can force through an option like this, because particularly nobody particularly cared or watched for this species, it's sending a bad signal all the way around, and it's actually fueling the opposite approach to fisheries management. The landings have decreased, and the landings seem to be the most biased information that we have showing that there's been a reduction in this particular species. And I saw the chart the other day, and it's down. But my understanding of it is that it basically derived from landing reports. But no one has taken into consideration, at least to my knowledge, that the landings have gone down because the number of trips being fished and the number of days being fished and the number of vessels out there are not the same. And if that link is the key reason that the landings have decreased, then that should be stated. But I haven't seen that tied to anything like that. There's no unit per effort there that shows to me that it's because of a lack of wolffish that we're not landing them. And, you know, like I say, if this can be generated from an office to say that we got a real concern about this, much like we did with barn door skates when we made them endangered, and took a long-lived species like that, and within 5 to 10 years, we rebuilt that to it's no longer overfished. This should send the same kind of message. Thank you.
The other, Mr. Libby.
Glenn Libby, Port Clyde, Maine. Seems to me, I know for a fact that we're not catching very many wolffish now because they're more of a shoal water fish, and our fishing now takes place in probably nothing under 70 fathoms most of the time. So they're all up inside. That's just where they are. People are catching them in lobster traps. We're not fishing where they are. I think if it is based on landings data, then that's probably why that's showing up like that. Thank you.
I see a hand. I don't see a face. Yes, sir.
I didn't think anybody wanted to hear me anyways. We just catch a lot of catfish in the shoal water also, and primarily when clam beds or mussel beds, and the reason we fish in the shoal water was for yellowtails, and we don't really fish for yellowtails anymore. Under 250 pounds, it's mostly a bycatch, so I agree on also staying off that. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. Tom.
Just a couple things of background info, because I noticed Jim Weinberg's not here. The assessment for wolffish wasn't based entirely on landings info alone, just to be clear. They also examined a number of different survey indices. I realize that there's always some skepticism about how accurate the surveys are. They also examined catch per unit of effort in the commercial fishery and in the recreational fishery. And the catch per unit of effort in the commercial fishery was based primarily on fishery observer trips. In the recreational fishery, it was party charter CPUEs. And, you know, I just want to point out for those of you who may not have had an opportunity that all of these indicators are down. In some cases, some of them dramatically, particularly the survey index. So, you know, I don't want council members to think that the only information used in the assessment was the landings data. There were a lot of other indicators that appear to indicate that the stock has declined over time, particularly since the mid-80s. Now, as Jim pointed out in his discussion yesterday, there's also some information in the assessment that doesn't seem to match the picture of a declining stock, and that is the big fact is that they don't seem to be seeing a decline in the lengths, which they would expect to see if the stock was declining. So that was, you know, highlighted in the assessment as well, that that piece of information seemed to be in conflict. The little background on the option that's proposed, which is the prohibition on retention, that is based in large measure on some work that has been done by Canadians, which shows that wolffish are very hardy when discarded from trawls. They did not do similar work with hook gear, but that a large proportion of wolffish survive when discarded from trawls, assuming there's not a spike through the head, that are returned to the sea, you know, within a couple hours of when they're towed up. And the Canadians will share that information with us. The other thing is there were two options that the committee looked at. One was to do it year-round, and the other was to do it, I think, from, you know, 9 months of the year or 7 months of the year. The committee chose to recommend the one option, the prohibition or retention year-round, because the period that was open accounts for about 60 or 70% of the wolffish landings in the commercial fishery and probably 90% of the landings in the recreational fishery. So the feeling was if you really want to get the benefits of this particular measure, you've got to do it year-round. Originally, the option with a shorter period was trying to tie it into some pretty big assumptions about wolffish spawning behavior. We know that the males guard the nests. We have a rough idea when spawning occurs. So we tried to narrow the window down to just cover that period. A lot of guesswork involved in that, quite honestly, because there's not a lot of details on all that type of behavior.
Jamal.
Hey, Tom, I think it was, I don't know, maybe yesterday it seems like, but earlier today you mentioned that we can't develop a rebuilding trajectory based on the data that you have on wolffish. And I guess my question to the service is, how do we handle that as far as, I mean, that's what we're supposed to do, set up a rebuilding program, yet we can't do a trajectory and we're doing what we think we can do. And how can you tie that together?
Well, I think you, and Tom may have mentioned this earlier as well, you handle it in the similar way that you did at Atlantic Halibut, that you make the argument that you've done as much as you possibly can or reasonably can, and that that should be sufficient to start rebuilding, and that as more information becomes available, we'll.
Frank Blount.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I voted against for this in committee, and I can say one thing. I don't know where the CPU for party and charter is coming from or the commercial catch. Commercial catch is going down because the western Gulf of Maine is closed. Cash's Ledge is closed. There's a lot of hard bottom in there, and that's where a lot of wolffish are caught. My personal experience in the last few years, we've caught more wolffish than we have ever caught. We don't catch them in southern New England. I know of one fish that's ever been caught down there. But I know when we fish in the Gulf of Maine, we're catching more now, and I know other people are catching them. I don't know if it's because they're in the closed area on the hard bottom, and it was always that way, but in the last few years, I don't see a decline in them. And I don't think a total prohibition is warranted here. And if it's the commercial catches going down, they're not on the hard bottom anymore in the Gulf of Maine, in the shallow waters anyway. So I'm going to oppose the motion.
Your Honor, on the council. Dave Gaethel.
I actually had several issues here. The first is the information we received yesterday. If you looked at it and you looked at the curve there, the landings, the most recent roughly 10-year landing period is the same as it was in the 1960s. And in between, there's a rise in landings. And that tells me that this is somehow related to water temperature. That we had similar conditions in the early 2000s to what we had in the early 60s. That's one thing. So what we do here may be largely irrelevant. The second is that I'm a little bit bothered by the fact that we don't have any alternatives here. If we vote this as written, it is the only option. There's no action option in here. There's no.
Yeah, there is.
Where?
Other than no action.
Where? But in the document itself, I don't see a no action option. Maybe that's a typo, but.
Tom?
No action is always an alternative. I mean.
Okay, but it's usually listed. It's not listed. All right, it's maybe a minor point, but I didn't want to be locked into having no alternative here. Like Frank, I voted against this. I think we need some options here, more than just what we've got right here, just one option and no action. So I'm going to oppose the motion.
Anyone else in the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Five opposed. Motion carries 12-5. Rip.
Next item is on page 128. Under the alternative two for differential days at sea and days at sea adjustment. Committee motion that the mixed stock exception will be applied when considering any change in differential days at sea counting.
Committee motion, discussion. Pat.
This may just be how it's worded, but this, it seems to say that you are going to use the mixed stock exception and not that you are going to analyze whether or not to use the mixed stock exception. Could you clarify that for me?
Well, actually, give me a second to check the meeting summary, but or my meeting notes, one or the other. But I believe the language was intentionally written that way by the committee. I think the original motion, and that's what I wanted to check, said the mixed stock exception will be considered, and I believe the motion was perfected to say it would be applied. But I don't know if that's captured in the meeting summary or not. You might want to keep going while I look. It may take
Well, if that's the case, then I'm opposed to the motion. I think the motion is inappropriate. You need to first determine whether or not the mixed stock exception applies and do an analysis before you can say that you're going to apply it. So I think this is certainly getting out in front of things. And, it may be a good idea for the council to certainly analyze the mixed stock exception in Amendment 16, given the litigation and the current situation. But to say you're going to apply it, I think, is inappropriate.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. David?
I'll bite. I think that it's on page 3 of the meeting summary, and I think it's captured accurately. We use the word applied because we wanted to make sure that somebody at least did the calculations applying the mixed stock exception. If you use the word analyze, then you can analyze it and, say, okay, we don't think it applies, and you never do the calculation to see what would happen if you had used it. So it was very specific. The language was for a reason. Again, it was based on what was at that time the ongoing court case. I mean, it had not been decided at that time. We didn't know how it would be decided. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't get into a situation again where we, because we had never asked to use it, to have it applied, that nobody ever used it.
Anyone else on the council? I'm at the disadvantage of not understanding how. Jimmy? How an analysis would look. I mean, I don't understand what this means. I mean, I know what it says. I think it means different things to different people. I'm just not sure what, mechanically, how this operates. Dr. Pierce?
Well, believe it or not, I was not the one who made this motion at the committee meeting. However, it is provocative, certainly, and it does relate to the motion that the council passed a while ago. However, I do believe it should be left in there. However, there's a lot of contingencies, such as the service may decide not to reconsider its position regarding the mixed stock exception. So an analysis may be done, and, it may not really bear any fruit. And I suspect that might be the case, especially since the council did say at our last get-together when we talked about the National Standard Number 1 guidelines that the changes that have been made render it impossible to be used. So, again, I say leave it in. The analysis would have to be done. But, of course, it's all contingent on what eventually the center does, what the service does decide to do. And that's kind of predictable. Nevertheless, I still think it needs to be in there to keep the discussion going on the mixed stock exception concept. And it follows from, the council vote of a while ago.
Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? Gene.
Well, even if you took the interpretation that it applies notwithstanding the plain language of the statute, this seems to suggest that you will require a mixed stock exception, regardless of whether you meet the criteria or not that are stated in either the old or the new guidelines. Is that what? I mean, if that's not what you're intending, then use a different word. If you're saying that no matter what, you're going to apply the mixed stock exception, then the word applied may make some sense. But if you're just saying you're going to see if it is justifiable for a given stock or stocks of fishery, then the appropriate word is consider. Consider the application or something like that. But this is totally confusing to the public as to what you mean. I don't understand the purpose of not being clear as to what this alternative means.
Dr. Pierce?
Well, perhaps a better way to phrase this motion to substitute, let's say, would be when considering any change in differential day at sea counting, an analysis will be done to determine if the mixed dock exception applies. And if so, then it would be applied. Okay? So that's a substitute motion.
Is there a second? Seconded by Rip. Discussion on the motion to substitute. Dave Gibb.
I don't want to belabor this point. We've been at it all day. But, you know, if we do it this way, I can see what the analysis is going to be. It's going to be the 11-page letter that we had this morning. It's going to be it doesn't apply, you can't use it. And that's not what I want for an analysis. I want to know, for example, I'll put an example out there. Let's say we're going to shut down the fishery because window pane flounder are shutting down the fishery. And I want to be able to consider the mixed dock exception in that case to keep the fishery open. I don't want the fishery shut down because some very minor stock is not performing well. And so my idea was that you come up with what the differential counting rate would be applying the mixed dock exception, which would exclude your window pane flounder. And that would produce two different rates. One would be with it, one would be without it. And then we would decide which one we wanted to go with based on our knowledge of the fishery and our role as managers. I'm getting a little bit frustrated because I can't, you know, I know that the language here is important. And the language, to paraphrase Joe Friday, will be used against me. You know, if I don't get the right words up there, somebody's going to figure out a way to legally outmaneuver me. And I want to make sure that we can consider this. This is a fundamental, basic concept that we have a disagreement on, both, you know, with the service. And so, you know, I'll defer to Dr. Pierce if he thinks that this language will make sure we get what we need. But if he's not sure, then I hope he'll change it to make sure it does get us what we need.
Gene?
Well, I was just going to point out, the mixed dock exception, the only place it exists is in the guidelines. So if you apply the criteria in the guidelines, that's what determines whether it applies or not. It's not, I'm not sure, what mixed dock exception are you referring to where you're not going to be subject to the way the new guidelines read?
Well, when the judge
it doesn't gets exist in the law.
Yeah, but when the judge gets done here, there may be a whole new definition of the mixed dock exemption.
Well, then that's what you would analyze.
And we don't know that yet, neither one of us.
Either way, you can only analyze what is legally in the law, whether it's dictated by a judge or whether it's in the national standard guidelines.
I agree. Point well taken. And all I'm trying to do is make sure that we can do that analysis, that it doesn't get somehow circumvented. And that's what I'm asking. If this language says that, then I'll accept the language.
Anything further from the council? Dave Preble?
Yeah, thank you. The problem I have with it on Dr. Pierce's version is that the wording is so convoluted that I'm not really sure of exactly what he's trying to do here. I think I know what he's trying to do, but I'm not sure because the wording seems very convoluted to me.
Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, I should have looked over my shoulder. It's not quite right. The motion was begins by saying when considering any change in differential. So get rid of recommend that the mixed dock exception will be applied. When considering any change in differential day at sea counting, comma, an analysis will be done to determine if the mixed dock exception applies. And if so, then it would be applied. At least the beginning part is cleaned up. So I think the intent's pretty obvious. I mean, you do the analysis, and if it can be applied, then you apply it. Implement it, adopt it, use it. Right?
Dave, you still convoluted?
Oh, this is way better. Way better. But I would say, let's see, if the mixed act exception might apply, and if so, then it would be applied. I mean, it doesn't apply unless you apply it. You know what I'm saying here? It's getting late, and I'm having trouble putting words together.
I don't want to break up the sing-along, which is going so well. But I mean,
is applicable. But done to determine if the mixed stock exception is applicable. And if so, then it would be applied. Is that what you're trying to say?
That works, yeah.
Anything further on the council? A motion to substitute as amended, reworked, and streamlined. Okay. Anyone else in the council? Anyone in the audience on the motion to substitute? On the motion to substitute? Senator Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through you to the members of the council, I want to try to assist my colleague from Massachusetts. I would suggest that the substitution should entail two components. One, a determination of applicability of the mixed stock exception, and two, a determination of the result that would ensue if it were applied. So that at the first level, you determine if it's applicable at all. And the second one, as policymakers, you could determine the result of the status quo or the result using the mixed stock exception. Then you could make an appropriate decision. I'll leave it at that.
Anyone else in the audience on the motion to substitute? Back to the council. Last chance on the motion to substitute. Ready for the question. All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Now on the main motion as substituted. Anything further? Ready for the question. Ready for the question. All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Rip.
The next one is on page 129, option 1, committee motion. The committee recommends to the council to adopt the PDT proposed multi-species recreational accountability measures described on page 16 of the PDT report with two changes. For the first bullet will read, if catches exceed ACLs, the council will determine AMs. The sixth bullet will read, the AM will be either or adjustments to season, adjustments to minimum size, or adjustments to bag limits.
Committee motion discussion. Sally?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify, because we're moving from section to section without really saying we're leaving one behind. And I had a motion on the previous section relating to measures for the commercial component of the fishery, so I want to make sure that we're not leaving that behind entirely, can return to that perhaps once this motion is dispensed with.
Yeah, still trying to get through the committee motions, and then there'll be an opportunity. We still have pollock to deal with, too. Let's not forget that. It's rebuilt. Okay. And then, you know, any other issues that council members individually want to raise before we take the final vote, hopefully, to put this out to public hearing. Okay. Pat Kirkle?
Yeah. With the changes that the committee made to the PDT alternative, then this is no longer an option that would meet the Magnuson-Stevens requirements for an accountability measure. You can't have an accountability measure that relies on the council taking some future action. There needs to be either something formulaic or some action that happens when an ACL is exceeded that will in the future ensure that ACL is not exceeded. And so I'm opposed to the motion. I think we should take this option out of the document since it's not a viable option.
Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, I can appreciate Pat's concerns about this. This, of course, stimulated a lot of debate. How in the world do we deal with recreational fisheries, specifically accountability measures in season, to implement some additional restrictions to slow down catch, for example, especially since we are not really in a position to know what's going on within the recreational fishery until long after the fishery is over, when we have to get the data from the Marine Recreational Fishery Survey, from MRIP. It's a dilemma. We face it with flukes, gob, sea bass. How do you respond in a timely way? And we haven't been able to do it with flukes, gob, and sea bass at the ASMFC and Mid-Atlantic Council level. It's been too difficult. Plus, when we announce, specifically at the state level, when we announce what the rules will be for recreational fishermen in any given year, and oftentimes it's in February of the current year, you have to somehow telegraph to the recreational fishing community how they're going to be ruled, especially party and charter boat operators who have to plan. They have to get charters. There's a lot involved with that as they anticipate the upcoming season. So you set seasons, they plan for it, and then if suddenly you determine that you've got a problem with catch, how do you first of all determine that relative to some target, and how do you respond? You really can't in season. It's a big problem for the state, specifically how to inform a recreational fishery for whatever species that, oh, by the way, we've just changed your bag limit. Oh, by the way, we've just changed your season. Tomorrow you're closed. It's unworkable. So I appreciate Pat's concerns, but in actuality, it is not workable. Therefore, I'm hopeful that Pat can give this, the service can give this some further thought in terms of how it actually could work in season with the database that we have to work with for recreational fishermen.
Anyone else in the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Pat?
Yeah, I'm going to move to remove option one from the document.
Is there a second? Seconded by Sally McGee. Discussion. Doug Grout.
Could you explain, Pat, what the difference? I understand that option two allows NIMS to determine the measures necessary to prevent exceeding the ACL. Were you going to determine it as a part of this plan, or are you going to determine them after the fact, because of course you won't have any landings data until 6 months afterwards. I'm just trying to get a feel for what the difference between the one you'd like to remove and the one that's still in there.
It's not the timing issue so much. You don't, and this is in part response to David's question earlier too. It's not that you have to have an in-season adjustment. The concern that I have with option one has to do with the fact that it would require the council to take action. Something has to happen automatically. It can't require a future council action to be considered in AM. So that's the difference between option one and option two. Option two doesn't require any council action.
But it requires NIMSA action.
That's right.
Dr. Pierce.
Option two requires NIMSA action, but not necessarily in the same year. Is that what you just said, Pat? So the action could be taken the following year to account for an overage in the current year?
That's my understanding of option two. Yeah. But Tom can.
Tom.
Yeah, I mean, the RA is basically right. Neither one of these options talks about an in-season adjustment. They're set up so that in fishing year one, if the recreational catch exceeds their ACL for however many stocks they have it, in option one, then the council takes a look at that and comes up with a decision on what measures they want implemented as AMs, and then hopefully those get implemented by the end of year two. Option two eliminates the council from that step, and that choice is made by the regional administrator to make those options, and they're implemented on the same time scale. So there's really, in concept, no difference in the timing. The problem, of course, is that inserting the council into the process implies that there's got to be a council meeting, and so that lengthens the process out as well, in addition to the RA's concerns that it conflicts with the Act.
Thanks, Tom. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just one final thing. While I recognize and appreciate Pat's concerns, taking the council out of the mix takes the states out of the mix, and these are recreational fisheries in state waters, so I really don't want to be taken out of the mix when it comes time to determine what the AMs would be. So I don't believe I can support the motion.
Pat.
Well, and I don't particularly want the responsibility. But the only other option is to have some sort of formula where we all understand exactly what happens. And the council can make the decision about exactly what that is. So it's in some ways it's a preferable option because it's also faster to implement. But it wasn't one of the options in here, so.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, it appears that we're having almost the exact same discussion we had at the Groundfish Committee. We wrestled this same beast around for a long time. And the reason the council decided, or the Groundfish Committee decided, that we ought to have an option that involved the council was because there are a lot of issues surrounding the recreational fisheries that are on a state-by-state basis and vary geographically throughout the region that we felt that the regional administrator may not be necessarily aware of, and that if we ceded authority over strictly to the regional administrator, that in this case, recreational measures may come out that would severely disadvantage some aspects of some states' recreational fisheries, either in state or federal waters. It wasn't just necessarily in state waters. We had a lot of discussion about the fact, for example, that if the measures were applied at the tail end of the following fishing year, that is actually the beginning of the recreational fishing year for most charter party boats in northern New England, and that they would essentially be shut out of the fishery just when they needed the revenue the most. The fishery, they would not be allowed to retain cod, as an example, in April, when in April is when they need to attract business. They need to pay off debt that they've incurred over the winter and things. So this was an attempt to give the public at least a chance to weigh in through the council process and explain why a certain measure may not work in a certain area. So I think we need to at least be cognizant of that reason. Now, again, we get into this whether it's legal, whether it's doable issue. And, you know, I do think we need to keep that in mind. When we had this discussion at the Groundfish Committee, there was not much representation from the recreational community. And I know this is very important to the New Hampshire party charter boats, that they their season starts April 1st. To be shut down before they even start would probably push most of them into bankruptcy because they just can't wait any longer. They don't start on April 1st because the weather's terrific and they love going out there in a snowstorm. They start April 1st because there's some cod to catch. There's people that want to catch a cod, and their revenue stream is, quite frankly, expired. So I can't support the motion as written at the moment for those reasons.
Anyone else in the council? Go to the audience. Joel?
Has anyone given any thought into VTRs? For the recreational people. You need the data. Make them do a VTR just like everybody else has to do. You guys love paperwork.
I don't, we've had so much discussion of this at the national level and everything, and, you know, we talk about ACLs and AMs, all the eight councils all the time with recreational, so we're not going to get it right, but over time, I think what the councils have to do is what the new ACL and AM final rule says, is that when you don't have a lot of information and a lot of confidence in landings, you set your ACL pretty low because you don't want to exceed it. And if you don't have confidence and you set the ACL low, then you're not going to impact the commercial fishery the next year. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's all a matter of accounting for everything. The less information you have, the more precautionary you have to be because everything is allocated and you don't want to hurt the other guy. So you set it low or set it, you know, precautionary, and then you adjust. But if you set it liberally, then you're going to be hurting other people in the fish. So it's a matter of ACLs, too, not just ACL.
Anyone else in the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Four. Opposed? Twelve. Motion fails, 4-12. So we're back on the main motion. Anything further on the main motion? Pat Kirkle.
I just don't want anybody to say I wasn't clear here. I don't think this is approvable. This option one. And so I don't want the council to think they can get to June, making decisions in June, and think that this is an option that they can include.
Okay. Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Ten. Opposed? Four opposed. Abstentions? Three abstentions. Motion carries 10-4 with three abstentions.
Next item is also on the same section, a committee motion. That separate AMs be determined for private boat, party charter, components of the recreational fishery.
Discussion on the committee motion. Anyone on the council? Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Part of the reason for this is because, and this relates to something that Joel just said, the private and the party charter components are very much different. And in fact, the party charter component already does VTRs, and so we have a much different data situation between the two groups. So we discussed this at length at the committee meeting, and that's where this came from. Thank you.
Anyone else in the council? Jim Adler.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Tom, but to refresh me in this, if I remember the conversation right, you didn't think that you could do this, you could separate them, or you were going to have difficulty doing that?
No, I think it's the opposite. We've the way Eric Thunberg does this stuff, we could come up with different measures for the private boat fleet as opposed to the party charter fleet. And so presumably you could do that for the AMs as well.
Anything further? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries 16-0, one abstention. Rip?
The next item is same page, option 2. Committee motion to include in draft amendment 16 for council discussion the PDT recommendation for accountability measures as described on page 16 of the PDT report. Wait a minute. Tom, help me with that one.
This is option 2 for recreational AMs. So, initially the committee said we're going to do the one option that it comes to the council, and then towards the end of the discussion, the committee said, let's put the PDT option in, which doesn't have going to the council, has the RA making the decision. So this is option 2 of the AMs. I think I will point out that I was a little confused on the previous motion at the committee level about separate AMs for party charter, so I put that in both option 1 and option 2. Technically, that wasn't a part of the committee, the PDT's recommendation, but I took the committee's motion to apply to both of the options.
So this incorporates option 2 into the document?
Yes.
Okay. Discussion from the council. Doug Grout.
Just a question on this option. Would it be make this not approvable, Pat, if we added something to this that said NIMS will determine measures necessary to prevent exceeding the ACLs following consultation with the council?
No, that wouldn't affect the approvability. I think it would only affect the timing.
Anything further from the council? Dave Gaith.
Yeah, I think the reason for including option 2 was the fact that we were trying to get something that the service was happy with. We were trying to have a range of options that the public could comment on. If, for example, the public doesn't come in and comment extensively on option 1, it'll render it, our decision will be easy. If Doug's language is included in option 2, then maybe we could eliminate option 1. We just wanted to make sure that the public had a chance to explain the nuances of the recreational measures.
Anything further? Tom Neese.
Yeah, just to highlight another difference that I kind of glossed over with option 2 is that whereas option 1 just says we'll pick from these types of measures, option 2 says this is the press priority order that we'll pick these measures. And the priority order is changes in season, adjustments to minimum size, or adjustments to bag limits.
Thanks, Tom. Anything further from the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Pat Kirkham.
Just one other quick addition. Option 2, I'm fairly certain option 2 is a proposed final rulemaking, so there would be an opportunity for the council to comment, too.
Okay. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. 17. Paul Howard.
Just, Pat, do we have to go through proposed final rulemaking for AMs? I mean, we it's the goal to get away from that, though, isn't it? If you got
one more. Yeah, and then I'll take it.
Well,
yeah,
as I said, you've got effectively two options. You can do it through some type of proposed final rulemaking, or you can have a formula in there that says this is exactly what happens if the AM is exceeded. And that in that situation, you're more likely to be able to just go directly to final rule.
But haven't we in the past on SAPs and other things given you the authority to ratchet down? And couldn't we, I mean, if we really want to stay within the limits on ACLs, isn't it easy to just say to you, you know, what we'd like you to do is do this, you know, lower the bag limit, lower the, you know, whatever it is. Isn't that it? Wouldn't that be an option that is a lot quicker than proposed final rule? I'm just concerned about going over and then the implications on.
I'd certainly like to find the simplest way that we can so that we're not all constantly in here talking about adjusting measures because of accountability measures. I'm not sure I can do a good job of articulating the difference, and maybe Gene wants to weigh in here, but the authority we have now to change the trip limits is simply to adjust trip limits to achieve a target, whereas an accountability measure would be to actually change the management measures because we've exceeded a target. So there is a fundamental difference there.
We have one last committee motion. This is under a general Amendment 16 business. Committee motion, the regional administrator can permanently authorize additional selective gear in any program or area that restricts gear, such as the rural trawl or other approved gear.
Discussion on the committee motion. Tom Neese.
See if I can summarize this quickly. In the vacated action framework 42, I think, we gave the RA authority to authorize additional gear in certain programs, Category B Day at Sea program and Eastern U.S. Canada Haddock. So this motion started at the committee by saying, you know, we're going to let the RA make permanent changes to the gears that are allowed in those two SAPs, and the committee said, let's just go one step further and make this a broader authority so that if we have programs with restrictive gear, the RA can permanently authorize additional gear in those programs if it meets the appropriate standards and goes through the council process for getting additional gear in programs, that kind of thing.
We're on the council. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Sixteen. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. The motion carries 16-0-1. As I understand it, that's the end of the committee motions. I'm going to call for a quick biological break.